morning, listeners, and welcome to a special episode of Riddles in the Dark, brought to you by the Mythgard Institute. We are, of course, holding yet another one of those special emergency episodes in response to last-minute spontaneous release of copious amounts of content by Peter Jackson and company. Yesterday was the lately proclaimed The Hobbit Desolation of Smaug fan event that was simultaneously held in multiple physical locations around the world and also live-streamed, and for which I failed to procure tickets for the LA one, unfortunately. I tried desperately, but did not make it. But nonetheless, the vast majority of the information that was released and content that was released there is available on the internet. So, as always, your dedicated, reliable Riddles in the Dark hosts have been plumbing through it, watching it, thinking about it. Okay, I'm kidding. We mostly just started watching it this morning because we were all very busy. But we are ready to discuss it now and to tell you our thoughts and to tell you what it all really means and to complain that the vast majority of the film has basically been spoiled and released already. So let's get started. I am your co-host, Dave Kale, and with me, as always, are my co-hosts, Trish Lambert and the Tolkien professor, Corey Olson. Okay. Good morning, you two.
Good morning.
Just how livid are you guys?
Well, not livid. I guess this is...
Disappointed, maybe.
I am feeling cautious, is how I'm feeling. And that's kind of, you know, my sort of opening spiel this morning. I just kind of want to talk about this because this is something I feel like we are entering into that real danger zone, or rather we have suddenly been thrust in overnight into that sort of danger zone that happens right before the film is released. What I mean is, it seems to me there are two places to be interpretively that are both safe and fun. One is in the period we've been in most of the year to this point, when we're speculating. You know, we know the book. We can draw, you know, we can draw some conclusions and think about things based on what we've seen. You know, we have what we got in the first film. We have things that are released and dribbled out here and there. And putting those kinds of things together and speculating about, you know, basically constructing theoretical storylines and weighing each one of them and thinking about how these things work, I find really fun, and a really fun way to engage with the story and to be thinking about the issues. And I mean engaging with the story, not just with the film, but with the book. I mean, I find that in thinking through these things, it really brings to light and sheds light on things that I hadn't really thought about with the Hobbit story before, and that sort of is a very natural thing. One of the things that is always really a restriction to one's interpretation when you're doing analysis of a thing is basically, what questions do you think to ask when you're reading through? That's one way to put it, basically in a nutshell, why I really enjoy both film speculation and film analysis so much, is that the stuff that the film brings up, the situations that are raised by the film, prompt me to ask questions that I might not otherwise have asked about the book, and therefore I notice things when answering those questions that I might not have otherwise noticed. So, as I say, that first place, that speculation place, is a fun place to be. The other place that is a fun place to be is in the place of analysis, when we actually have the film and we can sit down and think it through and really examine that story as a story on its own and think about its relationship with the book and do close comparison and contrast. I really, really enjoy all that kind of thing. What I don't like is the middle stage, where we're not speculating because we've been told most now of what is going on in the film. There are still some things that are mysterious, I suppose, but the number of things that we don't know about what's going to be covered and how it's going to be covered in the film, that is a shrinking category of stuff. But yet, we're not really in a place where we can do analysis either. See, this is the place that I think is kind of dangerous interpretively, where we have some information, but it's bad information. We don't actually know how it's going to be treated and how it's going to be handled and exactly what's going to be going on in the film. Spoiler summaries of somebody else's view of a film are one of the least useful kinds of pieces of information as far as really doing analysis of a story. I feel like, you know, you get all of the, some of the facts, some of which, you know, even assuming they're all correct, you really can't get any kind of a sense of a story. I mean, it's like reading a 5-sentence summary in a different language of a literary, you know, like a 5-sentence prose summary in English of, you know, the Dante's Inferno or something like that. Like, you're getting, you know, translated into a different medium and in a really crude synopsis, basics of what happened in something in a complete, it's just, I really dislike it. So I actually feel kind of, increasingly, the more gets released, the more sort of interpretively paralyzed I begin to feel. Because again, I can't speculate freely anymore because some of the storylines that I would think of or that I have been thinking of seem now to be wrong. So there's no point in continuing to indulge them and talk about them because if we know for a fact they're not happening. And yet, I don't have enough to work with to actually really do analysis of what we're told is there in the film. And so therefore, I kind of switch gears when this happens, and the gear I switch into is full speed reverse, that is not wanting anything to do with it and wanting actually to resist as much as I can the impulse to do interpretation, because interpretation, of course, as Sherlock Holmes says, you know, doing analysis of insufficient data is always deadly. Never speculate in the absence of the facts. And when we don't really know what this, you know, how the story is going to be treated, we can't draw conclusions about it. So if you draw conclusions about exactly what's going to be going on and what's going to be emphasized in this story based upon, you know, sketchy prose descriptions of what's going on, or even actors' comments or directors' comments or things like that, then you're likely going to be wrong, and you're likely going to bias your view of the film, in, I think, some kind of probably unhappy ways. So anyway, this is the interpretive situation that I feel is created by this kind of a flood of spoilers, and it always kind of makes me cranky. So anyway.
Well, I see a silver lining here. I mean, Jackson has saved me, you know, like, what, $18 or something, so I don't feel the need to get a ticket to go see this movie before the Mythmoot viewing of it. So, thanks, Peter.
Yeah.
not me. I'm going to go watch an opening night, so that...
Oh, gosh. See, now I may have to go with you, Dave.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, and I will. I will, like last year, I'm sure I'm going to see it early, I think.
Oh, I'm sure you will, yeah.
Because you know, last year there were people who wanted to do interviews on like the day the film came out, so I probably
right.
Not
so you had to go at like O Dark 30 to go see
exactly,
it.
Exactly. Yeah. Yep.
Well, I'm disappointed. I think, especially with the 20-minute, you know, report on the 20 minutes that didn't get streamed, that was shown only to the live event folks, only because there are scenes in there that I really would have preferred to have waited on to see within the context of the whole entire movie. I think it's kind of like you say now, it's kind of like I've snuck into my parents' closet and opened the Christmas gifts early. So there's no surprise under the tree, you know, but you know, I'm kind of trying to be optimistic and hoping that there's more. One of the things is, you know, Jackson seems to be a master of sort of, you know, dealing, you know, bits and dibs and drabs, but holding back some big stuff. And I'm hoping that's kind of what's the case here, that there still will be some, you know, some good stuff.
Well, having perused the highly interpretive description of the extra, the 20 minutes of footage, on the OneRing.net website. And by the way, on your point, Corey, like the One Ring writers are like exemplary at doing exactly what you said, which is like you don't get a description, you get a that person's interpretation of events.
And yeah, and that's actually
and they can't resist bearing their own little comments about like, oh, what about this? Oh, what about that?
Yeah.
And a lot of it's sort of like, I'm going to add my little aside here that proves that I'm a real Tolkien fan because I noticed this. And a lot of times it's like useless non sequitur stuff. It kind of annoys me. But anyway, I did just peruse it. Apart from a few things where it's like, well, that answered that riddle and that answered that riddle. They didn't actually give away that much stuff.
I didn't think so, yeah.
Yeah, a lot of it's just kind of like, A lot of it's just, you know, for example, and I'm not giving any real spoilers away here, but they showed footage of the dwarves in the boat with Bard being sort of smuggled into Lake Town. And really, like, when you read through it, you're like, they really didn't, you know, there's really nothing there. It's just, okay, so let's see. They're being smuggled into Lake Town on a boat, as we thought, and they don't appear to trust Bard, as we had already assumed. Didn't really give that much away. There's a couple sort of definite, like, there's a couple riddle answers in there that are like, oh, they've definitively answered that. But didn't really give anything big away. They gave no Dol Guldur material away. They gave almost no Lake Town stuff, and they gave very little Lonely Mountain material.
But I will say, the one thing they did talk about, and I will say there's one thing I did like about the write-up, is I really enjoyed, in fact, I was just talking to Laura about this yesterday in the Digest. Our conundrum from yesterday's Digest is, will the scene of Bilbo stealing the cup be in the movie? And we both thought no, because it's, you know, how are you going to do that? But what I liked is, that's actually how he kind of wakes up the dragon, I guess. You know, he picks a cup up. So they actually do keep the cup scene in, yep. Only that's kind of what wakes the dragon up. So that part I liked, and I look forward to that. It's, you know.
Yeah, it looks like that's in the trailer, the 3-minute
trailer.
Oh,
yeah. Yeah, that's right. We see that because it starts to
You see him holding a cup in
shift.
His hands. Yeah.
That's right. And I like that.
That's cool. I like that too. No, but yeah, Dave, exactly as you're saying, I mean, it's the thing. It's why, of all movie spoilers, my least favorite thing is the prose description by somebody else of a preview that they've seen. Because, again, you're not even getting data. You're getting an interpretation. And as I said,
especially people who insist on using it as an opportunity to look about the fact that they got to see it.
Yeah. Yeah, well, you know, that is a human weakness and perhaps natural enough.
Now, if Dave had seen it, we'd be getting his oral...
It would be completely unbiased.
Exactly. Yes. We'd get Dave's perfectly unbiased. Absolutely. Yeah.
What you would have gotten is you would have gotten a bootleg copy of it.
I don't mind, I guess if Peter Jackson wants to release stuff, he can release stuff, and I will still sometimes think that it's too much, but I don't like having my own reactions to the film, you know, my own interpretive responses to the film being colored by somebody else's.
I will give him credit
interpretation
that I will give him he and Warner credit that I think there's a very specific methodology here that they know that by releasing something that it tantalizes everyone, ranging from the people who saw it to the people who only heard that it was released and never actually watch it or read the descriptions. They know it tantalizes everyone that it on the whole, no one thinks poorly of him for this. No one's like, you know, well, that jerk Peter Jackson. The vast majority of people are like, oh, he's engaging with the fans. What a great guy. Right. And he knows that by doing it this way, where he does it in a semi-exclusive event that's closed and there's no recording of it available and stuff, that the only people who will really end up seeing it or hearing, you know, hearing details of it are the people that really want to, and that it's very easy for everyone else to avoid it. So,
You
gotta give him credit. They are geniuses.
Yeah, no, he does it very well. He does it very well. And I'm actually thinking, I haven't fully decided yet, but I have not read the One Ring write-up, and I think I might not, actually.
You're really not going to be able to resist it.
Oh, I bet I can.
You know what, Corey? I wouldn't bother.
There really isn't
very much in there, and it certainly doesn't add to your, you know, experience.
No. Like,
yeah.
Well, really, if anything, it spoiled me, because, I mean, you know, the scene where he names Sting, I wish I could have done without that. I mean, I want to see that in the movie. I don't want somebody describing it to me.
Yeah. But, I mean, I don't know. There's so little that can really be spoiled of a movie adaptation of a book. Because even if I read someone's description of the scene, you know, that's not a whole lot different from reading the scene in the book.
Like, yes,
seeing it
exactly.
on the screen, seeing it on the screen is still a different experience.
Yes.
I think.
Yes. Exactly.
The only scene I would say we get some wood elf politics scenes and some all of the scenes from the wood elves that it looks like they released Those are much more novel content spoilery. So those are everything else is kind of like, that's what we expected. So, but I don't think it adds that much to have for me to have read it. I've read it now and it's like, oh, all right. Well,
Yeah.
I'm not really, it's not causing me to anticipate anything any more than before. But it also hasn't diminished things much. So it's a overall a neutral. So I would
Yeah.
say I wouldn't bother.
Okay. Well, let me give
And
a.
anything to avoid visiting the onering.net on this one.
I wasn't going to say that, but
I'm just being a jerk. I'm just being
Yes,
a jerk. It's
Dave
just,
is being a jerk. That's okay.
that's okay.
But let me.
So one comforting thing, Corey. One
Yeah, okay.
comforting thing. The guy, I think it was Demosthenes, the guy, he goes to a lot of these things, and he claims at the end, and I actually generally think that the OneRing.net people have a bead on this kind of stuff, on sort of the strategy of Peter Jackson and the Warner. He says that there was no Bjorn, no Dol Guldur material, etc., and he says that probably there won't be before the film. And that apart from a few tidbits here and there, like vlogs or whatever, that probably there's not going to be much more content released. So I think we can rest assured that there probably won't be too much more stuff released between now and the film.
Yeah, the one thing is that Peter Jackson in the recent video log did say that he was going to release more.
No, come on,
No,
man.
that he was going to release another video blog. But those are mostly
Oh,
behind
okay.
the
Well,
scenes, you know, like
those usually
filming
give away
of the movie.
those usually give away like one or two things, but not much,
There
so.
was very little given away. I mean, as far as totally new stuff that we didn't know or anticipate. I mean, we mostly saw, you know, them posturing in front of green scenes for scenes we've already seen in trailers, you know, that kind of thing. So, and you know, like a profile of the new like substitute second unit director guy. So, you know, those things were certainly nothing that was film spoilers exactly. But yeah,
You talking about the vlog?
I'm talking about the dialogue, yeah.
The one scene that I found that took my attention, probably the only one that really took my attention, is at 1:14, 1:14, which looks, it's Thranduil fighting in Lake Town. I
Okay.
believe he's fighting orcs. So that one I found interesting.
Well, since you've brought it up, we might as well look at it.
I mean, you could just jump right to that point.
Let's see.
At first I thought maybe it's Dol Guldur, but there's snow on the ground, and I think that's a Lake Town
Yeah.
brand thing.
Let's see.
Look back at the pickups that we did in May, June, July this year.
Action.
10 weeks of very, very intense shooting for both the second and third Hobbit movies.
That's awesome!
Maybe. This is Lake Town, clearly. So this is the goblins in Lake Town that we saw before. Lakes, so pushing poor Lake Town peasants into the icy
And
water
that
of the
looks like,
lake.
oh, I can't really, no, it looks like a Lake Town person. I was going to say maybe it's a dwarf, but
Yeah,
no.
no, I think it's a Lake Town person. And then
It's a little bit beyond
this
this.
is Thorin wrestling with someone.
Hard to tell.
Sorry, so this is
Not
the.
an
There it is.
orc,
That right there,
interestingly
right there,
enough. Right there.
Yeah,
There, you got it.
this is it. Is that Lake Town? You've got stone cobbles, though.
It's definitely not. I mean, I'm tempted to say it's definitely not Mirkwood, but I suppose it could be.
We've never seen
What
snow.
about those? What about the like fortress, tower things that we've previously the thing from the Lego set?
The thing from the Lego set.
Well, I
Maybe
guess that's
Thranduil
true. I
will
guess
make an
it.
appearance in the Lego set after all.
Yes.
Maybe he wasn't
I
just a
guess it.
bonus boss figure.
We thought they'd just crowbarred him into that, but maybe in fact that is
Exactly.
actually accurate.
Right, so
Well,
at.
I mean, I was thinking it could be Mirkwood, but again, the snow kind of
Yep,
threw
it's
me.
true that we have not seen snow, and certainly that scene that we've seen 100 times of Azog jumping up onto the parapets, does not, I mean, does not look like there's any snow in the background. That still looks like green foliage in the background. So, but maybe as time is advanced, maybe this is in the latter half of the film, and
Well,
we
it could
have
be.
orcs advancing, and that's when
And they
Azog
are,
comes
that
in.
orc is armored, where the other orcs were not armored, right? I mean, this looks like it could actually be an armored orc in a on purpose assault of Mirkwood. so it could be later in the movie.
Yeah, well, they're definitely, look, these are bareheaded goblins
here. Oh, they're there, that's true, yeah.
I mean, they've got
some armor.
I was
thinking the orcs from Dol Guldur, you know, the ones where we see them marching in ranks, have those kind of, like, the head
right.
helmets and
right.
stuff.
Yeah, I mean, these are definitely, I mean, they all have helmets, whereas the other orcs all did not. So it does look like they could be two different goblin units here.
Or the goblins, or perhaps these goblins were smart and realized that running around in Lake Town next to the water wearing full armor, not a great idea.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah.
In the well, those guys look like...
Water, you slip and fall in the cold water wearing heavy helmets and armor.
you're out of there.
Back to
well, these guys actually look like the guys that have been hanging with Azog, these guys here in Lake Town. But the other ones, I mean, I do think those look like the Dol Guldur armored orcs.
Yeah.
Anyway, it could be.
Possibly.
I mean, one of the things from the One Ring write-up also is that the scene we've seen where Tauriel's yelling at the orc, you know, they've, like, captured an orc, that seems to go a little further, and that's the orc that actually clues Thranduil in that Sauron that they're dealing with, and apparently he gets really worried.
Yeah, let's see, here's the description of this second unit director. This is your life, second unit director.
And that's Gandalf.
Right, outtakes from Gandalf and Radagast. Okay. Mm-hmm.
How does it feel to be the B director, second unit director?
Awesome, apparently.
Actually, it's not even that. It's the splinter unit.
It's the splinter unit.
Splinter unit.
Yeah, exactly.
He makes a point of saying it's not the second unit, it's a splinter unit.
Like the C director.
Yes, exactly.
But he's been with Jackson for 22 years, so.
You get to film all the scenes that will get cut.
Oh, and here's Legolas in Lake Town. More definitively.
Three, two, one,
wearing ropes.
Don't mess
got this spider thread attached to him everywhere he goes.
Spider thread, exactly. He just can't accept. He can't escape it. So here's, I guess.
Where do we think
this?
That's at?
This is Tauriel fighting with the orcs, and I think this is the one that we've seen many times before where she ducks over backwards and you know, to miss the orc attacking her from behind. Where is this? If this is the same kind of battlement thing that Thranduil was fighting on, I guess, possibly, or that Azog attacks, maybe that's what's happening here. It looks like, looking at this, this is an elvish.
That looks elvish,
thing.
Yeah.
Yep. So
now there's also a fire, you know, there's a sconce there with a fire, so it's not like it's an undefended spot.
Right. Yeah, true. In fact, doesn't that suggest that it's an indoor spot?
Have they invaded... Have they invaded the Elven King's
the
halls?
Caverns? That's what I'm wondering.
That's
exactly
what
I mean.
Scene of Thranduil is.
The green screen in the background certainly makes me think, like, I wonder.
Yeah.
What's going to be overlaid on top of there? Sky or caverns? That's an interesting question.
Yeah, I mean,
it's interesting that these scenes here, the more we get of these and the more we see of, like, the just straight up elves and goblins fighting. No dwarves, no Lake Town people, whatever. The more they're really making explicit the notion that the Elven King is under assault.
Yes.
You know, previously it was like,
definitely.
Oh, he's being encroached by the corruption of the forest. And now it's like, no, he's literally being invaded by orcs. It's not even just this nebulous, like, boy, the forest is getting kind of creepy. And it's, you know, the creepiness is getting closer and closer. And then also there's orcs in it right there. So, and now we know what that elf is pointing to.
And that same elf blows on
there's
horn,
the,
too.
The invading army is right over there.
Yeah, exactly. And here's Toriel in Lake Town.
God, boy, they really get her in every scene now. They're fighting orcs in the Elven King's Hall. Orcs on the tower. They're fighting orcs in Lake Town.
I saw a post on Facebook the other day that said, Desolation of Smaug, 35% fewer hobbits and 45% more elves.
Yeah. they're battling them everywhere.
Well, here's one thing that I liked about this. That is evidence that Evangeline Lilly has apparently read the book, or at least spoken to someone who has. Listen.
Tolkien describes the Sylvan Elves as less wise and more dangerous.
I don't think we can hear
Tauriel is...
I can't hear it.
Oh, we can't hear it, of course. Darn it. Sorry. In my haste, I forgot to do my to
you
get
can
my
give
speakers.
Us your
Hang on.
Let me,
I'll get speakers. Wait a second. Wait a second. We do want to hear.
We could talk about the infamous Tinkerbell line, which I have a lot of sympathy for her about. The poor girl is going to catch so much stuff for that remark, but I totally get what she meant.
Yes. Yes.
In fact, I thought of you, Corey, your comment about Tinkerbell in
Tinkerbellism,
one of your
yeah.
lectures.
Yeah. Yeah. No, and there. I have made Tinkerbell my, you know, my sort of poster child for, you know, everything that is inappropriate about modern treatment of fairies.
Oh yeah, that's right.
But yeah. So
here's the really important thing: for every scene that Tauriel is fighting orcs, that's a scene that she's not engaging in romantic looks with Legolas or anyone else,
and therefore
or
a scene
with
gained.
Legolas.
So like. Or just delivering lines in general. So, you know, by all means, keep her busy.
Right, right. Okay, here, let's see.
But we know that Keely's going to get left behind in Lake Town.
She did explain, was it yesterday, or was it in the thing where she talked, is this what you're going to do about the Sylvan Elms? She was explaining about the Sylvan Elms.
Yes. I am now. Yes. Okay. I am now done with my hardware adjustment. Ready?
Excellent.
Okay. Anyway, as I was saying, evidence that Evangeline Lilly has read a book or spoken to someone who has. Darn it!
Freaking thing. Okay. Now, no, seriously, now I'm done with my hardware adjustment.
Tolkien describes the Sylvan Elves as less wise and more dangerous. Tauriel is a little bit reckless and doesn't quite have the self-control that I think a lot of the other elves do.
You like death? Then let me give it to you.
Echo.
So she doesn't have that kind of floating, ethereal thing.
Do you not think you would allow your son to pledge himself to a lowly Sylvan Elf?
No, you're right, I would not. Still, he cares about you. Do not give him hope where there is none. If he around and...
Anyway.
I like that scene. finger.
It's fascinating. It's on the one hand, it's certainly evidence that somebody that she has at least read the Wikipedia entry on Sylvan Elves.
Yes.
And yet the interpretation of it is unclear. That what Tolkien meant by they're, you know, less wise, more dangerous is they run around with their knife unsheathed half the time, stabbing whatever's in front of them.
Yeah, well, exactly. I mean, you know, that's of course the whole point, is what exactly did he mean by that? You know, in what sense were they more dangerous? And certainly one sense in which, I think the book invites us to interpret more dangerous, is because it's right in the same context of that remark that the narrator tells us that if they have a fault, it's distrust of strangers. So I don't find it at all, you know, not in keeping with what Tolkien seems to be suggesting there, to suggest that they, you know, might be short with strangers or and possibly more merciless to their enemy and quicker. I mean, the fact that they imprison Thorin and the dwarves, they don't kill them and they treat them well when they're in prison, in the sense of like feeding them well and stuff like that. You know, they don't torture them, they don't starve them, they don't kill them out of hand. But more unpredictable, you know. And so anyway, I think that it's interesting. You know, just first of all, merely the fact that at least the actors have been coached that Thranduil and Legolas and are different from the rest of the elves of Mirkwood. That's not something I was taking for granted.
Also, apparently, Sylvan elves can't hold their liquor because, again, in the write-up, it looks like Bilbo does get the guards drunk, and that's how he steals the keys to let the dwarves out.
Yeah, interesting.
So Trish is just determined to give away all the spoilers in the write-up.
Well, people are going to go read it themselves.
I'm not.
Corey's not, though.
Sorry.
Anyway, I find that interesting. I find it interesting that I'm not saying that I'm necessarily assuming now that Evangeline Lilly has like read,
is an expert.
But again, she not only, she either has read or has been coached well enough that she could not only know the concept, but quote the line. So, hey, props. I just give props for that kind of thing. Let's see. Yeah, we got Thranduil standing around. Lee Pace, talking about what a jerk Thranduil is. Here's, I think, the last money shot of the vlog here.
We'll take some catching.
And so do burglars.
Right, with the implication there clear.
Martin Freeman managed to get his middle finger up again. That's something that shows up in the extended editions thing.
so we do have evidence of what's going to happen with the ring there, that he's going to use it as an escape mechanism to run away. So that, I think, we always knew that that was going to be a challenge. We always knew that. I mean, we've been saying since like the first month of the first year of this, that there's no way they were going to do the conversation with Smaug and Ringvision. And so, we always knew that Bilbo was going to be visible to us. And so I think it's a fine way around it, one of the objections I have to, it's actually an example of what I was talking about before. I've heard people complaining that, it doesn't make any sense. Like, this is just nonsensical for Bilbo to be visible when he's talking to Smaug. Smaug would just eat him. Like, why would that happen? It doesn't make any sense. This is a bad interpretation. I don't agree. Or rather, I think it's something that we should suspend judgment about. I don't think that that's necessarily nonsensical at all. I think it's an example of people kind of jumping to fairly facile conclusions, which I don't think are really warranted, because you don't know anything about how exactly he's going to be characterizing Smaug. It seems to me quite likely to be in the character of Smaug, to toy with someone that he finds crawling around on his horde, feeling sublimely confident that he's going to be able to catch him and eat him, not anticipating, of course, that he's going to be able to make himself invisible and escape. So I actually think that that's, that seems to me to be able to work very well, that even if Smaug does see him, he would have this conversation with him before destroying him. And then Bilbo escape unexpectedly to Smaug, and therefore make Smaug really ticked off. That actually seems to me to work perfectly fine as a storyline. I think it's interesting. I think it will be interesting to see what it exactly how it actually plays out on screen. But okay, let me kind of give a preview of our order of events here for the rest of the episode. There are
30 minutes in,
and we've not actually started talking about the things that we really plan to talk about. And first of all, let me reassure you, there's a new 3-minute trailer, of course, that we're going to talk about. And you guys know our previous record, so you're probably thinking, okay, well, they're going to take 4 hours to talk about the three-minute trailer, and then a bunch of other things. So this is probably going to be a 6-hour episode. I don't think so, because most of the material in that new 3-minute trailer is old material. Some of it is new, but not most of it. So I don't think it will take us an hour per minute to discuss the new trailer. That is my projection. But there are a couple other things we want to look at. The first thing that we want to look at is the posters. We have a couple still images that we want to take a glance at. And then we want to talk about some comments that were made in the big article in Empire Magazine that was just released this past week, which I think there's some interesting things there. And then we're going to look at the trailer. And then we're going to have a bonus riddle this week. We actually do have a riddle that is not... You know, of course, we don't have an overarching topic for the day today, but we are going to have a riddle. So stay tuned for the riddle there at the end. You guys ready to do stills?
Take it away. Bring it. I say bring it.
Number one. So here is our first still. This is an older poster from a few weeks back.
5% more elves.
That's right.
That's right.
That's right. not a hobbit in sight.
What's the thing at the bottom? Is that an orc wearing a...
This guy?
No, I think it's an elf. We talked about that online. We think it's an elf. It's part of Thranduil's soldier.
The little shadow things there are... It's like a...
Those are orcs.
Yeah, it's like a taxonomy of... It's like a silhouette taxonomy of different types of orcs that have appeared in Lord of the Rings films.
Right, you know...
The last one is Azog on his white wolf...
But you know what I love about this? I love the self-parody involved in this. I mean, because this is, it's like an orcish parody of the little silhouette line of the Fellowship.
That's right.
And I think
the dwarves that they did last year on the building in Wellington.
Yes.
Where they had the, yeah.
Yeah, I think, I think that's really cool. Yeah, I mean, I guess if we're to understand, Dan, who's this dude?
We think it was Bolg, but you know
that's my hope, of course.
Yeah,
and
been absolutely no talk of him whatsoever.
Looking back,
miscellaneous orc.
Yeah, looking back, I can't remember when the day was when I suddenly started cheering for Bolg with like all of my being. You know, why somehow for some reason, and I don't remember when it happened. You know, the return of Bolg to the film has become like one of the things I'm really rooting for, and I don't quite know why.
Well, I'm getting sadder and sadder about it. In the extended edition extras, they talk about the creation of Azog's character.
Yeah,
and they talk about kind of all the different things that they envisioned of him. You know, for him, and one of the things they envisioned was Bolg's. You know, they actually had the guy in Bolg's outfit and said, "Oh, well, this was originally Azog, and we changed." And I'm like, wait a minute, what, you're rewriting history? I mean, you're not even mentioning Bolg in that context? So I was really disappointed.
Yeah. No, but, you know, for people who got that Bolg action figure, man, hang on to it.
Big bucks, that's
hang
right.
on to it. Wish I'd have bought it. it was right there. I was holding it in my hand at one point. I remember I was in Nashville, Tennessee, and I was holding it in my hand. It's very interesting. Well, we'll see if he gets a cameo or something. We'll all cheer.
Not a lot to say about this, you know. I mean, I'm kind of getting over fatigued with all the drawn bows elves thing.
Yes,
Randall's nasty face,
especially the repeated images of elves drawing bows in ways that seems to physically be impossible to shoot an arrow in any sort of reasonable way. Like pulling the, drawing the string and the arrow back into your throat.
Well, maybe Toriel's arms are like 5 feet long.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Come on, Toriel, you can do better than that.
By the way, what is whose cape is that? Is that supposed to be Thranduil's cape that's kind of enveloping all of them?
Yes, I think so, because you can see it down here thrown over the arm. So yeah, I think that's exactly the idea.
Doesn't he look kind of goofy lounging on his throne like that?
He does.
He doesn't actually have his leg up over the arm of the throne. It could be worse.
This poster looks like a real, like a comical 80s fantasy film poster to me.
It does.
Like, I look at it and I'm like, this looks like the kind, like something I would see on like a, you know, like a really low budget 80s fantasy, like
Zardoz, Andy says.
Not that Willow was low quality or low budget, but it was rather hokey.
Yeah. Well, I mean, actually, you know, there are moments when Lee Pace's Thranduil reminds me of David Bowie's Goblin King.
Totally.
You know, totally. In Labyrinth. So that's what I am always thinking of. But
yeah.
And not always, not every single time, but there are moments when I am reminded. Here's the second one. And
what is the blade? It's along the right hand side.
Yes, this is a blade. I assume it's not Orcrist, so I'm assuming maybe since Thranduil seems to be the motif of this whole poem, or this whole poster, rather, that this is Thranduil's sword or something like.
It's not Orcrist, but it's certainly Orcristi.
Orcristi, yes, it is Orcristi. See, here's the here's the real Orcrist here.
I don't see any runes or anything on it. It's just all.
Yeah. Yeah.
So anyway,
so this other one, I have to jump in on this and just take the lead here and say, the one thing that struck me about this new poster, everybody's got their weapon out except Gandalf, who is smoking a pipe.
Yeah.
That's Gandalf's true weapon, his intellect.
Yes. Yeah.
Is that a dragon coming out of
this? Yes, the smoke from his pipe is a dragon breathing fire into the bowl of his pipe.
And the wings stretch out across Bilbo and Thranduil.
Yeah, I mean, I love that artistically. And notice this. Look at this. You got the dragonish whirl of
tail.
Smoke. The tail, like, wrapping up around Thorin's head. Notice this.
Okay. Well, maybe it's not so bad after all.
So the thing that strikes me about this is that by switching hands to drawing their bowstrings with their left hands instead of their right hands, Legolas and Toriel both improve their form.
Yes. Yes.
And we now know that they're ambidextrous.
Yeah. They're left-handed in one poster, right-handed in the other poster. Bard, of course, unfortunately, cannot draw a bowstring properly.
Well, he explained that yesterday. You saw that, didn't you? How he's, because it's a long bow, and he turns his hand around so he can get a long, he can stretch his arm back longer.
But he's pulling it into himself again. Like,
but he's back, it's his hand's backwards, you know, it's like what you would not normally see.
Couldn't they have hired someone who actually knows something about archery to
Well, I mean, we will see how it actually goes in the film itself. I'm willing to sort of forgive these things because these are just for still shots. These are just poses, you know, poses to look good. If when he's drawing the black arrow to shoot at Smaug, he's pulling the string back into his body like that, I'll be pretty disappointed, but.
They did save money on the artwork. If you notice, the Thranduil is exactly the same in both posters, and Harold pointed that out on the.
Oh yes, it is exactly the same head. So here we see now. Here's what his invisible hands are actually doing when his hands don't turn into Legolas. This is in fact what they do. He's holding that wand thing he has.
I think he's going to start dancing. I think it's like a beginning of a dance or something. You know, that's what I was thinking of.
Really does look like that,
doesn't it? I will now do an interpretive dance of the First Age.
Yes.
Yeah, I can see that. Now,
Rivendell has the Hall of Fire. The Elven King has the Hall of Dance.
That's right. He just has a fabulous studio with lots of mirrors, and yes.
That's right, that's right. And Thorin's holding, is that Orcrist?
That is Orcrist, yeah. Mm. Thorin's holding Orcrist, which is interesting. I mean, based on the trailer and based on what we know from the story, he does have it at the beginning, so, right. You know, presumably.
That's actually Legolas's hand.
What, he's bowing before, well, Legolas reaches around behind him and holds Orcrist up in front of him tauntingly. Yes, I guess that's, okay. Could happen. Interestingly, you know, but
what's in the upper left-hand corner? What structure is that?
I think that's a nod towards Dol Guldur, because we have this clearly elvish, well-lit construction back here behind Tauriel and Legolas, but this, the dark tower, greenish, blue light thing, that's got to be Dol Guldur.
It looks decidedly sort of Cirith Ungol. It's very Mordor. It's got very much a Mordor kind of look to it. So yeah, it's probably.
You'd think Sauron could do a little bit different with the decoration, but you know, I guess he's kind of in a groove there.
Yeah.
Yep.
Instead of when you're trying to hide your identity, don't build things to look exactly like the other place.
Well, see, that answers the question: how is it that Gandalf figures out that the Necromancer is really Sauron?
His eyes looks oddly familiar.
Right, by his decorating choices, of course. I recognize this interior motif. It's Sauron!
Yes.
But then remember, Gandalf wasn't around when Mordor was you know, before Mordor got thrown down.
He read a detailed description of it.
Oh, in Minas Tirith.
Minas Tirith, yeah.
Yeah, there was probably a coffee table book in Rivendell that...
Mordor in pictures.
Yeah. I think that this poster. I find this poster about 10 times more interesting than this poster.
Yes, me too.
I mean,
there's a Hobbit on it too.
Yeah. Well, I mean, just with the way that it's, you know, I like the way that it's composed. I mean, you've got the light and darkness, you know, sort of symmetry of it, and the cluster of characters. You know, you've got Thranduil facing the opposite direction of Legolas and Toriel, them right under the light, you know, in the in sort of the sunlight, him over here underneath the looming black tower, which is questionable. The way, as I said, that the dragon-like smoke wraps up around Thorin, but also embraces both Thranduil and Bilbo in its wings, which I think is also interesting.
I can forgive Gandalf his pike now because of that very cool dragon.
Yeah. And then Bard, of course, balancing these other archers and pointing in the other direction. Ironic that he's the one pointing down, but again, that's the same thing we've seen of him. Which again is interesting. Instead of, you know, when we think of Bard and archery, everyone who's familiar with the book is imagining, of course, the famous scene where Bard points up with his bow. And we've never seen him pointing up with his bow. We've always seen him pointing down. That is, he's always, you know, like covering the dwarves or taking them captive. That is to say, the sort of visual theme that we've gotten, the repeated visual motif with Bard, is of him as antagonist. Or at least as sort of potentially threatening figure, and not as ally, and not even yet really as dragon slayer.
We keep forgetting that this is also how he feeds his family, by shooting fish with
right. Exactly. Because it's well known that people who live in fishing cultures, on lakes, tend to be expert bowmen, because there's a much call for that.
He's an iconoclast. He's like, I don't need no stinking nets.
That's right.
Yeah.
Andy Higgins has let us know.
This is why he's an outlaw. Because he won't wear the hat. He refuses to stick to the city ordinances about proper ways
about
to
fish nets. That's right. By
a
the way, Andy
or real.
Andy Higgins has let us know that the Mordor Coffee Table book is available at the Rivendell gift shop.
That's right. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, well, no, this is cool. And I think, you know, and then, of course, we haven't talked about Gandalf here in the middle. You know, this is I assume that, you know, they're going to be releasing a series of these posters with, like, different characters as the central, you know, that there'll be a Thorin poster and a Bilbo poster and so forth. You know, here we have the Mirkwood Elf poster, and this one appears to be the Gandalf poster. Interesting how he is, while centrally and prominently placed, not the most, he's the least active of all of the people who's depicted here.
It's not like he's striking a pose with Glamdring.
Exactly, or his staff. I mean, we've seen him in action shots in the trailers already, but we don't get him even holding a weapon, much less actually in action. Even Bilbo, who's not in the same kind of action pose as, say, our archers are, you know, even, again, even he is at least holding his weapon.
We just got a link to supposedly all of the character posters.
No time. We'll do that on another occasion.
Thanks, Daniel,
but I'm not going to tempt myself. Yeah, I thought I saw a reference to that set somewhere online in the last day or two, but I didn't have time to look. And yeah, we'll definitely come back to that. I think that those are interesting.
Not that interesting. I'm looking at them right now.
Okay. Well, I always like looking at them, but it's fine. We'll. That's later if we do that. But
the thing about this one is, it is not to give the marketing people too much credit, because I'm sure this is not what they intended. Although maybe, but it is very appropriately Gandalf, because he is the prime mover of all of these events, and as usual, not through his sword or his staff, just by sort of kind of being there and kind of nudging this person that direction and whispering something to this person.
Yeah, I like it. I mean, I like his, you know, and his look. It's like, you know, it's not like I am calm and wise. It's sort of speculative and uncertain. You know, he has a little bit of that, wait, what is that kind of look on his face, you know, which again seems to be, I mean, what this looks like to me is, you know, Gandalf, the solver of riddles, the figurer out of things. And I think that seems to be his primary role in this film, they've kind of captured that pretty well. Want to say a few things about the Empire magazine stuff. We've got some stuff. Trish, you have selected out some nuggets.
I did, and I want to thank our man on the street in the UK, Andy Higgins, for providing this information, because it's not available in the States. So he actually sent me scans of the article. I read through JPEGs to get this. There's some interesting stuff about, now Boyens, Philip Boyens, is quoted in the article. I'll read what she says, and I must say I want to hear what you have to say about this, Corey, because I'm not sure I agree with what she's saying here. She says, Smaug is the physical manifestation of one of the themes of the book, greed to the point of sickness. There is an obscenity about him. It is dragon sickness. That is the wonderful phrase that Tolkien uses. This creature is driven by this illness, this utter sense of greed and avarice, but it is beyond greedy. It is its own thing, a living, breathing energy that he has. He will not part with a single coin. The dwarves carry a little bit in their hearts, too. The part I don't agree with is I don't think Smaug is sick with the illness. I think he is the embodiment of this greed and avarice. He's not. He doesn't have an illness.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's that's tricky, because on the one hand, are dragons themselves corrupted? Yes, in a sense, though it's not like they were ever whole. You know, it's not like Smaug needs healing or something. I mean, I'm not sure I would have put it that way. Because again, it makes it, you know, he's driven by this illness. Again, it makes it sound like Smaug used to have a happy childhood until,
or that,
you know,
if he could be cured of it, he wouldn't do
exactly
that anymore.
It's
the essential nature of dragons to be this way.
Right.
I mean,
it's
not even Tolkien. I mean, that's kind of
that's a very very old idea. I mean, that's why we, you know, the traditional idea, which is so which is the same idea as the dragon sickness thing ultimately, or rather comes from the same place. The traditional concept, even more dramatically depicted in C.S. Lewis's Voyage of the Dawn Treader, when Eustace becomes a dragon, Tolkien in The Hobbit and Lewis in the Dawn Treader are both thinking about the same tradition, which did say, as Lewis depicted, if you become too greedy in your heart, if there is this a treasure and you are contemplating this treasure greedily, you can become a dragon. That's how Fafnir, the great Norse dragon, became a dragon. He was originally a human being, and his dragon shape is merely an expression of his. I say merely; he's literally a dragon. It's not just a symbol. But his transformation is spurred by that exact, you know, sort of character thing. He's, you know, Fafnir is like the original Eustace. And, And similarly, the dragon in Beowulf. You know, there are, you know, it's uncertain about his history. And there are even, you know, there are some threads of interpretation which suggest that Beowulf's dragon was a human, you know, who turned into a dragon. So that's that kind of idea. So yes, in that sense, the dragons themselves are the embodiment. They are the perfect illustration of. They are the sort of largely irreversible, sort of conversion to that way of looking at things, and that kind of corruption.
The difference in Tolkien is, I mean, the dragons are actually a distinct species, right? He didn't carry through that tradition of metamorphosis like that.
No, exactly. There's no evidence in Tolkien's works of any actual literal physical metamorphosis in that way. What he does is he sort of just changes that into a purely moral transaction. So we see Thorin becoming corrupted by the dragon sickness. We see, somebody like the reference to the fact that the Master of Lake Town succumbed to the dragon sickness, you know, being someone who's very prone to such infections. But again, the implication there is that the Master of Lake Town didn't have far to go. He was already very dragonish, in his outlook before. So, you know, again, he didn't really need to be turned. He was practically there already. But in this way, dragons are so with Tolkien, there is a little bit of a middle ground in the sense that they are not symbols. You know, it is not just that the dragon is sort of the figure for this kind of greed, which people turn, you know, the physical transformation of somebody into a dragon merely makes outward a state which was already inward. He keeps that inward state as an inward state and makes dragons into an external thing, while still giving them the characteristics that are associated with dragons in this way.
Now, I do like, that they're sticking, I mean, they're making this a thing, you know, I mean, I don't know what else they would do, frankly, but I mean, I do like the fact that this is such a big deal, and the fact, you know, like, he won't part with a single coin and all that kind of thing. Armitage says it's going to be fast and mobile and bloody terrifying. He can get into people's heads, which is kind of interesting. That's kind of a Glaurung, I mean, Smaug had that ability too, I think, in The Hobbit, but Glaurung for sure, which is kind of interesting.
Exactly. And that's something that I think has been interesting to think about from the beginning. When in The Hobbit, Tolkien talks about Smaug, you know, having rather an overwhelming personality, and saying things like, you know, this is the danger of dragon talk, and describing as he does Bilbo having these impulses to run out and reveal himself. Smaug does clearly have, you know, mental, sort of mental and spiritual powers that are like Glaurung had, in his ability to influence the minds of others. And that's, of course, as shouldn't be surprising, because Glaurung had already existed in several versions before Smaug came around. So Tolkien, even within, you know, within his own writings, already had a good model for that. So we shouldn't be surprised, I think, to find that, even if it receives less overt treatment in The Hobbit than it does in the Silmarillion or any of the earlier Silmarillion texts. That doesn't surprise me, and I think it seems to me therefore entirely in keeping with how Smaug is depicted in the book for them to do a little bit more of that. But again, I wasn't taking for granted that was going to happen. I think that's pretty interesting that they're going to do that kind of thing. And I wonder, you know, I wonder how dramatically are they going to tie those two things together? That is, the direct influence that Smaug has over the minds of people and Thorin's corruption. Because in the book, of course, that's not very explicit. Bilbo is affected by Smaug while he's talking to him down there in the room. Thorin's dragon sickness is, in that sense, totally independent of Smaug. There's no evidence that at any point in the book, Smaug turns his mind and attention upon Thorin in order to influence him, but I wonder if that's going to happen in the film.
We do have the little teaser in the extended edition now of The Hobbit, which is that Thorin overhears Elrond telling Gandalf that he's concerned because Thror and Thrain both went insane, and he's worried that Thorin might do the same. So that's kind of seeding Thorin getting a little nutsy later, and I'm wondering if that is more of it. I wonder if they're going to do that more than the Dragon Sickness, although I don't know. You know, given Boyan's remark, it's going to be interesting to see how that plays out.
Yeah, yeah. No, I agree. I agree. And, you know, and then we have the stuff with the... Oh, we should mention the stuff with the Arkenstone.
Yeah, well, let me finish this one about
okay, yeah.
Smaug.
Oh, yeah,
there's
yeah,
one
yeah.
Other, oh, there's two other, actually. There's two other points. One is the next characteristic, which is also very dragon-like. She says, why doesn't he kill this little creature? I mean, people are going to wonder, why doesn't he just kill Bilbo? She says, ultimately, he's vain, and Bilbo has this one little instinctive moment to play to that vanity, which sort of works. And we do see that in the book, too. So that's kind of cool. I mean, he's going to be obviously have that characteristic as well.
Yeah. Yeah. And
then I'll finish this one off and then let you...
Yep.
Comment so we can kind of move on to the Arkenstone thing. Jackson said we do play on the speculation that Tolkien later went into how much Smaug and the Necromancer were in some sort of alliance.
Yeah, I think that, you know, remember, I'm the one who keeps bringing this up. You guys had kept squelching it. You're like, oh, no. Let's hope that doesn't happen. And I keep saying, you know, we got to think about this.
I've been on board for that all along.
Oh, yeah. I know you have,
I'm
Dave.
I'm letting Corey have his moment.
I know you have, Dave. But anyway, yeah, no, I, you know, it will be interesting. I will be, I'm still wondering, as I have been wondering before, if we're going to actually get anything like a messenger or any kind of direct communication, or at least an acknowledgement. I could see, for instance, Smaug making a reference, even perhaps a veiled reference, to Sauron and his, you know, arising. But yeah, I do think I will be interested. I'll be interested to see how that works, because that's something that I think has always been a very prominent possibility from the beginning. But though Jackson is pretty elusive in what he says about it here.
Now I'm going to shift over to Thorin, which is getting more toward the thing that you wanted to bring up about the Arkenstone, and I'll just read the first two notes. First of all, the first note is, with Gandalf branching off in his own secret assignment in Dol Guldur, film two finds Thorin reasserting his status as mission leader and taking things in his own direction, which Armitage admits isn't necessarily for the best. He says, as the journey goes on, they keep getting themselves in bother. It's as if they are tripping towards the door. And then he goes on to say, what's really exciting is that at the beginning of the second movie, we establish the importance of the Arkenstone and why we need a burglar to get it.
I still find the Arkenstone stuff weird. I have found the Arkenstone stuff weird from the very first time I saw film one. I still don't understand it. All of the comments that they have made about it have not helped me to understand it any better. They can say how important it is, but I still don't understand exactly why it is so important, whether it is of merely symbolic importance or whether they are actually claiming some kind of magical, or to use the word which was objected to so strongly from the first film, divine, you know, power to it that... It gives that, I don't know. I don't even know. I have no idea. One thing I will say, though, I think this is a fascinating solution. I think that what they're doing with the Arkenstone, in part at least, what they're doing with the Arkenstone provides an answer to what I consider one of the biggest unanswered questions of the Hobbit book as Tolkien left it. And that is, what the heck do they get a burglar for? What on earth good is a burglar going to do them? It's entirely pointless from the beginning. I talked about this in my book. I mean, it's, I mean, and this, you know, frankly, I see as a result of the way the Hobbit book unfolded for Tolkien. You know, it started off as this, as a treasure hunt, you know, as a, you know, fairy tale treasure hunt. And so, yeah, we wished we could get a warrior or a hero, but they are all taken. So, we fell back on burglar. And the implication, the only implication that I can see that makes any sense there is we want someone to steal the treasure. So if we can't kill the dragon, that's what we'd want a hero for. If we can't kill the dragon, we can't hire somebody to kill the dragon. Therefore, we'll hire somebody to steal the treasure for us, so we can still get the treasure. We won't be able to kill the dragon, but we'll steal the treasure, and that's what we're that's what we're after.
Which is nonsense.
Well, at least it's maybe not nonsense from the point of view of chapter one. That is, from the kind of story we seem to be in chapter one. But by the time we get up to chapter, 11 and 12, when we're entering the Lonely Mountain, in fact, then it no longer makes sense, because the story has grown, the world has grown, the Lonely Mountain has grown, Thorin's position has grown. You know, in chapter 10, all of a sudden we're now in a Return of the King story. And we get all those prophetic songs about Thorin.
The only thing that hasn't grown by then is Bilbo's role. His role has shrunk to engage in some petty theft.
Well, right. Well, basically, the thing is that the book acknowledges the absurdity of it. I mean, Bilbo objects to this. You know, he's like, what did you expect me to, when he steals the cup?
Right.
And they're like, hey, you stole the cup. Hooray, we have part of the treasure back. This is awesome. And the dragon comes and they get all scared, of course. And then afterwards they're blaming him. And he's like, what did
you
expect me to
do? Why'd you steal that cup?
Yeah. And he's like, I'm a burglar. This is you didn't hire me to kill dragons. You hired me to steal treasure. And then he complains, right? And he's like, look, you should have hired 100 burglars, not one. It would take me 50 years. So basically he recognizes this really was just not a well thought out plan all along. But there's still a problem. And I know it seems shocking for me to suggest that there is a hole in the Hobbit book, but there is a hole in the Hobbit book. And here's the hole. It's basically Tolkien, in the way the story developed, Tolkien kind of painted himself into a corner, because he already had the burglar thing. And in chapter one, Gandalf is the one who ratifies the burglar thing. You could chalk it all up to the cluelessness of the dwarves alone and be like, here's just another example of Thorin and company not knowing what they're doing and being a comic troupe. Well, fine. Except Gandalf was the one making all the portentous statements in chapter one. He is the chosen and selected burglar. It's Gandalf's authority on which they take him. Gandalf obviously has ratified the completely dumb burglar plan, it seems.
Or come up with it, actually.
Exactly. Now, how Tolkien gets out of this, it's not that Tolkien doesn't escape this corner that he's painted himself into. He does. And he escapes it brilliantly. And the way he escapes it is through the theft of the Arkenstone. Bilbo steals the Arkenstone. In the end, he has an important burglar role to play. Burglary does play into it. But in the end, he's not stealing for the dwarves, he's stealing from the dwarves. And it's the theft of the Arkenstone and his attempt to establish peace, the way that Bilbo steps out against that culture of dragon sickness, which is threatening to consume both sides of the conflict in the Siege of the Lonely Mountain. That's that's sort of Bilbo's moment, and that's the climax of the burglary, of the whole burglar theme of the book. And so, what Tolkien does with it is brilliant. I think that's fascinating. But in my mind, there's no question that he's getting himself out of, by doing that, he's getting himself out of the corner that he painted himself into.
Well, it is kind of an after. I mean, it's like the Arkenstone doesn't even come into play until Bilbo's actually in the mountain, right?
Right. And when it does come into play.
Definitely he smells of like, I need to come up with some way to get out of this. Yes,
right.
Absolutely.
And when it does come into play, it initially has an entirely different concept. I mean, the first references to the Arkenstone in the drafts of The Hobbit are as a reward, a portable reward.
Right.
Like Bilbo obviously can't take a 13th of the treasure all the way back, to Bag End. So they give him a portable version. Hey, there's this really valuable gem we can give you, and that can be your 13th share. And Bilbo's like, oh, okay. So he's going to, they intend the Arkenstone, which isn't initially called that. It's called the Gem of Girion. They intend the Gem of Girion to be his reward, his prize for being successful. So anyway, so the point is, even when the Arkenstone does come in, which is late, It's obvious that he does not have the concept that he later had, because the whole role of the Arkenstone turns around 180 degrees from the thing they planned to give to Bilbo to the only thing they would deny Bilbo in the whole horde. I mean, it's like an absolute 180 degree turn in the role that the Arkenstone plays. So again, basically, this is to say, we see what Tolkien eventually gets to with the burglar theme, but it seems relatively clear that it starts off as kind of a comical thing, and back when the story was much simpler, and even in a different kind of genre, back in chapter one, when chapter one was started. So in the film, so what does Peter Jackson do? Now we see what Tolkien does later on. In The Quest of Erebor, what he's doing is that, you know, The Quest of Erebor being told from Gandalf's point of view, we get basically an apology for Gandalf. You know, Gandalf wasn't just being clueless. Gandalf wasn't just overlooking this. He was thinking about stealth, you know, so you get Gandalf not thinking about burglary at all. In fact, using the word burglar unwillingly. In The Quest of Erebor, he's talking about stealth. You need stealth. You need something. You need professional stealth. And that's what leads the dwarves, and it's in 100% the dwarves' idea, to think of burglars and burglary, and Gandalf kind of goes along with them. That's how Tolkien handles Gandalf's, what looks in retrospect like Gandalf's cluelessness in chapter one. That's how you know, we get sort of the Gandalf revisionist version of what was really going on in his mind there in chapter one of The Hobbit. So, this is a long wind-up, but the fact that in Peter Jackson's film, apparently, they have, in fact, a plan. There's a reason they hired a burglar, and it has nothing to do necessarily with the secret door or any of that stuff. It has to do with the... They actually need a burglar. They need something stolen, apparently. They need somebody to sneak in and steal something and make off with it, which is, in fact, what a burglar does. And that's really interesting to me. I mean, is it a major deviation from the books? Yeah, it is a major deviation from the books. But what I would say, this is only speculation, can't know 100% for sure, but my speculation would be, if when Tolkien was sitting down to write The Quest of Erebor, if The Hobbit weren't written, you know, had he not already been, you know, committed to the story he already wrote back in the early 30s, would he have done it differently? Yeah, I think, no, I'm not saying he would have done it this way, but I think he would have done it differently. I don't think he would have had chapter one work out the way that it did, and Bilbo join on the same principles that he did. So what you can see, I think, you know, Jackson and Boyens and Walsh doing in their planning here is making the burglar thing make sense while keeping the burglar thing. You know, one option would be to just downplay the burglary. Remember, that's what Tolkien did in The Quest of Erebor. He tried to downplay the significance of Bilbo as burglar. Peter Jackson said, no, I'm not going to downplay the burglary. Instead, I'm just going to contrive a way in which the burglary becomes a central thing. And how does he do it? The same way that Tolkien does eventually, by making the Arkenstone the centerpiece. The Arkenstone be the thing that Bilbo can say, now I am a burglar indeed, when he picks it up. Under totally different contexts, apparently, and for very different reasons. Again, I'm not trying to say that it's exactly the way that Tolkien conceived of it. Totally different, the way that he's conceiving of the Arkenstone. But again, what I think we can see here, and this is what I've seen in the Hobbit films all along, is a real commitment, much more of a commitment, to actually keeping the elements, fitting them into a different framework, but really preserving these elements in ways that didn't necessarily expect them to be.
I think two things about this, but I think, you know, my thinking is Jackson is actually Silmarillizing the Arkenstone, and I think he's doing it on purpose. It's almost like he's saying, well, we can't really make a movie for the Silmarillion, but for those of you that are fans of the Silmarillion, I'm going to give you this element.
Yeah.
Because Thranduil, I get the sense that Thranduil is going to go all Fingal on us with regard to the Arkenstone, and I think the Arkenstone is going to be one of the driving forces that causes me to lay siege to the mountain. Well, I may be really extrapolating here, but...
Well, but again, how appropriate is that? I mean, we see Thranduil having that very kind of attitude in the Hobbit book. And of course, you know, I mean, he is the analog to Thingol.
I mean, I'm kind of looking forward to it. You know, it's like probably the closest we're going to get to see the Silmarillion on screen.
Yeah. If you squint, then it looks like Thingol and the Silmaril. Yeah.
Exactly, right.
Yeah.
The thing I'm disappointed in Jackson about, though, is why didn't you even at least say a little something about the Arkenstone during movie one? I mean, we got it in the beginning, and Thrord, you know, looks upon the Arkenstone as his divine right to rule, and we get it in Niall Finn's song at the end. But at no point during movie one is there even, like, a throwaway line about the Arkenstone, like between Balin and Thor. You know, we don't have any hint of it, and I'm a little disappointed in Jackson for that. That now in movie two, suddenly it becomes this really central thing. But anyway, that's just me being critical of his story progression.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, I don't know. Yeah,
maybe he didn't think of it until maybe he's like, told maybe. Him, maybe he didn't think of it until later.
Maybe. Yeah, perhaps. I mean, goodness knows that stuff in the prologue could have been added later.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, let me move on, because I know we want to do
the trailer,
but I do have, I'm going to just go to two other notes from the Empire Strikes Back article. two things. First of all, I'm going to go with the, I'm trying to pick which one to do first. I just have to go back to, now we're back into the 70s, okay? You ready for this? The fetid air of Mirkwood is alive with mushroom spores, sending the party into a delirium. The labyrinth of tormented trees came painted in outlandish hues that will twist and warp. Armitage says that they spend all their time in Mirkwood like they're stoned.
That's fascinating.
Okay. Could probably do without that.
So I'm like, gosh, you know, you're talking about movie posters from the 80s. Now we're in movies from the 70s, you know, like Yellow Submarine or, you know, I guess The Hobbit. But The Hobbit didn't have that, did it? But... The Rankin Bass Hobbit.
Yeah. No, it didn't. But, you know, it sounds like, I wonder if that's simply going to be the replacement to the Black River, basically. The scene, you know, remember our shock, Dave, when we saw them carrying Bomber? You know, we were like, well, obviously they're going to cut the Black River. And and then we saw them carrying Bomber and we're like, what? They're actually, you know, maybe... Maybe he's going to somehow OD on, you know, the mushroom thing.
Maybe he, especially Bomber, because he probably eats the mushrooms.
Right,
or
exactly.
That's true.
Interesting. Okay.
But no, I mean, the reason Ed is chiding me for finding it interesting, Ed thinks it's revolting and not fascinating. The reason I say that, Ed, is that, again, Mirkwood has in the book, there is that magic, that, you've got the river, which creates dreams, not hallucination, not waking hallucinations, but dreams, you know, that they would make it drug trippy. I'm not a big fan of that, but at the same time, the idea that Mirkwood would have some kind of sort of warping mental effect on people seems, I mean, I'm going to withhold judgment there because I can see that working in one of a couple different ways and similar to what we can see happening.
We talked a little bit about this. We speculated that that if they did the river, the cause of its hallucinatory effects on Bomber were going to be more that we suspected that they would change it to be caused by the corruption. And the evil, not by just general sort of fairy enchantment.
Exactly. So
that's what it sounds like here. Yeah, it sounds like that's what they're doing.
So this would just be kind of pushing it even further in the direction we expected they were heading in.
Right. So instead of having just the one river, like the forest is dangerous and dark and scary, but mostly non-magical, except there's this magic river that you have to be very careful not to drink from. Instead of having that, it's more generally dispersed. That's why I find it interesting.
Or it could be taking the fairy element out of it entirely. Because remember in the scenes of Radagast in Mirkwood, those mushrooms, you know, we saw those mushrooms all over the place. And it was kind of tied to the, you know, the encroaching evil. So that it could be, you know, they could be going totally towards Sauron with all this stuff in Mirkwood and no longer any of the fairy elements.
Yeah, and of course all the death of the little woodland creatures, you know, so we can see the deadliness of it.
That's right. I'm going to move on to the last one because we're anxious to get on through the trailer here. So, but this is one that also I think we're going to want to talk a little about. The dwarves break into two halves after Lake Town. This is after Lake Town, so it's interesting. I don't know that Killy gets injured, so has to remain behind. So I'm not sure about this after Lake Town thing. It almost sounds like none of them are any longer in Lake Town, so I'm not sure about that. But that's what it says in the article. The dwarves break into two halves after Lake Town. Killy gets injured, so has to remain behind. I mean, that when I first read that, I'm like,
could we be talking about when they're on the side of the mountain, maybe some of them remain behind on the side of the mountain, some of them are a part of the expedition party that's kind of sneaking Bilbo in through the front gate.
Could be.
Maybe. I mean, it's hard.
That sounds better to me, because I know there is that one scene in the book where they go try to get the ponies, isn't it? Or
yeah.
You know,
we've had the scene of some of them on the, on let's call it Ballin's balcony.
Yes.
Where they're like, just like 50 years later, they're standing there hiding from Dragon Flame, and I'm just like, oh, God, you
right.
know, like, just back here again.
Right.
So maybe only some of them are there, and then the other ones are up, sort of up on the side of the mountain with the ponies and stuff. Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, that would make sense, and that kind of splitting of the party is at least suggested in the books. My biggest problem is not, I mean, okay, yeah, I don't see any good reason to split the party, but what on earth are they going to do? I mean, what, seriously, we're going to leave Keeley and them behind in Lake Town for some reason? I mean, what would they do? How do they get reunited with everybody else?
I'm
just trying to imagine what kind of storyline that could lead to. I am completely blank on that.
Maybe what we're really heading toward is that they're not even going to make it to the Battle of Five Armies. He's just going to get injured along the way, and they're going to be like, well, leave him.
That's right.
And he dies of his wounds.
Yeah.
Yeah. On the side of the road.
Yeah, we're going to have to take Keeley out back and shoot him, I'm afraid. It's the farrier's pistol for poor Keeley.
Put him out of his misery. You have to do this to dwarves when they get
in. We'll have a touching moment with Thule. We'll give him a nice last meal. I don't know. I mean, I guess, where does Kiwi get injured? He looks fine in his barrel. Maybe in the end of the barrel sequence he gets injured. But
I agree. You know, I had the same thought as Ed. You know, maybe there's some kind of magical telecommunication where it ends up Keeley being the one getting a transmission from Erebor that tells Bard about the dragon or where to shoot the dragon.
Well, if he does get injured during the barrel ride, you know, all I can say is, told you so. We told you to wear helmets.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. There's obviously improper safety precautions being taken. And I think that actually would be a good moral lesson, you know, for people. Like, you shouldn't try this at home, and see, this is why you shouldn't try this at home. Because,
right.
See, look, even in the movie, people get grievously injured.
Keeley, don't bitch. I mean, Bomber's the one that should be complaining. He's the one that got trebucheted, for God's sake.
Oh, yeah. Yes, well, exactly. True. Exactly.
Okay, right. Well, anyway, so those are really the high points of the article. So,
yeah.
That's... that done.
Okay, well, let's look at the trailer.
Pretty disappointing.
Yeah.
I, we're really, truth be told, not disappointing. At this point, I'd rather just leave it alone. I want to watch the movie.
Yeah. I also am rapidly approaching that point. Well, here's our trailer. Yeah, let's just go through it.
Seen that before.
The Lord of Silver Fountain.
Dave.
The King of Carvenstone. The King beneath the mountain shall come into his own. And the bells shall ring in gladness at the mountain king's return. But all shall fail in sadness, and the lake will shine and burn. You have no right. No right to enter that mountain. I have the only right. What is this place?
The desolation of Smaug.
Destroy the dragon. Take back your homeland.
The dwarf never be king. Our time has come again.
It is not our fight.
Are we not part of this world?
You seek that which would bestow upon you the right to rule. The Arkenstone.
What's that?
That. Master Burglar, is why you are here.
We are in grave danger.
The world is in grave danger. feel for you.
If this is to end in fire, then we will all burn together.
We can't give up now!
It never ceases to amaze me.
The courage of hobbits.
I'm really glad. I'm really glad they inserted that one little scene there in the middle where Balin reminds us the name of the movie,
right?
Or why it's named that?
Yeah.
Right.
Why is it called this? Oh, thank you, Balin.
I am Sherlock under the mountain. So the
very first thing that jumps out to me, I'm diving in, so I get to go first.
Yeah.
The very first thing that jumps out at me is I believe that the Lake Town reception situation has been clarified.
Yes.
What it looks like to me is Bard stumbles across these dwarves, not knowing who they are, and expects a hostile welcome and smuggles them into Lake Town, upon which time it is revealed who Thorin is, hence Bard's reciting of what is apparently the prophecy. And then we get a reversal where now the dwarves are being welcomed by the Lake Town, and Bard is like, no, this is bad, guys, bad. That's my take. Yeah.
That was my favorite part of this trailer. The fact that we're getting some of the poetry radically changed, subtly, but radically changed. Let me just remind us of the song in the book. So this is in chapter 10, A Warm Welcome. We've got the song. It is given to us as an example of the, you know, one of the exuberant songs that the people of Lake Town sing about the king beneath the mountain. The king beneath the mountains, the king of carven stone, the lord of silver fountains, shall come into his own. His crown shall be upholden, his harp shall be restrung, his halls shall echo golden to songs of yore resung. So notice we have all of this is pointing to the future. This is all very cheerful predictions about what is going to happen when the ancient line of the kings from the past is restored in the mountain and all of the wonderful things that are going to happen as a consequence. And wait, it's not just about him giving us money. The whole region shall be, in some sense, magically affected. The woods shall wave on mountains and grass beneath the sun. His wealth shall flow in fountains and the rivers golden run. The streams shall run in gladness. The lakes shall shine and burn. All sorrow, fail, and sadness at the Mountain King's return. I'll do that last one again, because it's the important one. The streams shall run in gladness. The lakes shall shine and burn. All sorrow, fail, and sadness at the Mountain King's return. Remember, so the final note of this song is that all sorrow and sadness shall fail when the Mountain King comes back. So at the return of the Mountain King, all sadness and sorrow will be gone forever. But of course, in the middle of that stanza, we get that one ironic, ominous note. The lakes shall shine and burn, which of course is going to be fulfilled as a prophecy, but of course it's not going to pan out quite in the way that people expect. So the ironic foreshadowing of that line, the lakes shall shine and burn, completely outside the perception of the people singing it, to whom it is merely another one of those instances, like the streams running in gladness and the grass beneath the sun. Everything's going to be bright and beautiful, and you know, nature itself will be rejoicing in happiness when the Mountain King comes back. That's all they're singing about, but we do get that one glimpse forward at the ominous thing that's about to happen. So Bard recites a version of this there are two things that I would point out. I want to go back and listen to it again, having just sort of refreshed our memories about the song and the book. I want to go back and look at it again. One thing is that he appears to be reading this, and from the expression on his face, we'll look at it more closely, it sounds like he's discovered this. Like, he's found this prophecy which other people have forgotten about, that he's, like, unearthing it or something. At least that's the impression that I get from this. And that's why he becomes the grim-voiced, which is appropriate, prophet of doom, telling everybody what is going to happen. So let's move forward a little bit here. Here is where the voiceover starts.
The Lord of Silver Fountains. The King of Carven Stone. The King beneath the mountain shall come into his own.
Makes it sound like a bad thing.
And the bells shall ring in gladness at the mountain king's return. But all shall fail in sadness, and the lake will shine and burn. You have not...
All shall fail in sadness. This becomes a prophecy of doom. That when the mountain king returns, everything's going to go south. Everything's going to be destroyed. It's going to be awful. That is fascinating. Fascinating.
Do you think it's possible... Do you think it's possible that maybe what he's doing is riffing on or reinterpreting the prophecy? Maybe the people are all reciting the prophecy, but Bard, being the downer that he is making up his own version of it?
Maybe. My question is this scene right here. He looks to me like he's reading it. Maybe he's just reciting it intensely to somebody who's sitting down or something.
Yeah.
And that's why his light...
staring at his own hand.
Right. Right. I like to rehearse prophecies while staring at my hand in a room full of hanging things. Maybe. But it's this shot right here, this visual shot, that...
Yeah, it looks like he's reading.
It looks like he's reading. And he's in this cluttered room, right? So this is... And that's... I think that's what suggested to me discovery. Like, you know, here in this, like, you know, whatever it is, this storehouse, this attic, this lumber room... He's come across this thing and is looking at it and saying, you know, and his face is clearly disturbed. He doesn't, it doesn't look like the face of somebody who's saying, well, let's recall this prophecy that we all are familiar with.
He might just be suffering from heartburn.
It's possible. You can't rule that out, I suppose.
Do you think he, what he dug up like an old book that his granny recited to him while he clutched his dolly?
Exactly. Exactly.
Do you think maybe it's he just bothered to read the entire prophecy that these people are all reciting, like the first four lines that sound good, and he just kind of... And then in this scene, are these people celebrating or demanding that someone be burned at the stake?
I'm gonna go with celebrating, though.
Yeah, I guess they're hoisting. Yeah, they look like they're singing.
Who is this? Is this Bilbo?
Bilbo?
Has he got bare feet? Looks like it.
Yeah, it looks like. Who's standing next to him?
The master? I mean, this is the person addressing the audience. He's got long... He's got
Thranduil.
It kind of looks like Thranduil. I mean, I... Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I still don't have... I mean, we've still only seen the Master of Lake Town so few times. I don't have a real sense of what he looks like without his hat, which he's not wearing. But anyway... Assuming this is, see, and again, you've got it put on. So listen, here's the second verse of that, the incredibly ominous verse of the prophecy.
Shall come into his own, and the bells shall ring in gladness at the mountain king's return. But all shall fail in sadness, and the lake will shine and burn.
And the lake will shine and burn. But. There's a but in the middle of that second verse. The bells will ring in gladness, we're getting, while we get this. The bells will ring in gladness at the Mountain King's return, but all will fail in sadness. while we see Bard hugging his beautiful daughters. And Trish, wasn't there something in the Empire magazine about Bard being a single parent?
Yeah, he's a single father.
Yeah, so we got
and
him.
We know he's got two daughters and a son, at least. So.
Yeah, the single father of these two kids.
And he also is kind of a Robin Hood character living in a controlled state. So he's got a very, it said in the article that he's got a strained relationship with they call him the mayor of Lake Town.
Yeah. Yeah, Joshua Bowden just brings up a thing, and I was wondering, too, that is this dude the knife-wielding stooge of the Master, possibly?
Yes.
The Black Hood look makes it look like it.
It's about to stab Bilbo.
Wherever he is. Yeah. Kim...
Ellen claims it's almost certainly the Master, having just looked at the HD trailer.
Okay.
I'm not buying it.
Not buying it?
This
is the Master?
He looks kind of short for...
But who else could it be up there with his hands up addressing the crowd?
I think it's his servant person.
No, I think this is... I mean the Bilbo guy is the stooge.
No, I think that's Bilbo.
I don't know.
Yeah, well, maybe you're right.
With the black cloak and the hood? Yeah, I don't know. But anyway, yeah. Anyhow,
I don't know if it really matters that much.
No. Interesting, though. Anyway, okay, so we've got, so again, the prophecy, we've got the bells shall ring in gladness. So they're indulging at least a little bit in some of the same kind of unknowing irony. You know, the bells will ring. Of course, the bells are also going to ring an alarm, which is recalling the bells of Dale, which were described as ringing when the dragon was attacking. So, you know, we will get presumably the bells ringing again here in Lake Town when the dragon is attacking. So the bells that were rung in gladness are going to ring an alarm. So we have our sort of ironic touch there. But then we just end with the line which contained dramatic irony in the book, "The lake shall shine and burn," made into a simply a threat. "The lake shall shine and burn." You know, and that's really fascinating. So, I'm really interested in that. And it makes me want, and again, but see, even here where we have this, you know, them taking the song and shifting it around, notice the things that, you know, as they're making changes, what seem to be very significant changes, notice the elements that they're keeping. They're keeping the element of prophetic songs. That wasn't a given to me, that they would be
too.
Keeping the element of prophetic songs.
Yeah, I'm just glad they have that.
Yeah.
I think it's cool that they put that in, because we never had a sense up until now in any of the things that we've seen that was going to be included.
They're also keeping the very significant book element of Bard as grim-voiced prophet of doom. Remember, he's the one who prophesies poisoned fish and things like that.
They just have him starting it earlier in the story.
Right. Which, of course, Tolkien would have done, too, had he thought about... Yeah. I mean, Bard didn't exist when he wrote Chapter 10.
That's right.
I mean, he thought of Bard while writing the Dragon Attack chapter. So Bard... what they're doing, basically, it seems, is giving a mechanism to this. Instead of having Bard being like, "I'm just a guy who, like, sometimes gets an itchy feeling that we're going to have some poison fish or something." Other than somebody who's just, like, a pessimist who's got to be right sometimes, they're giving him if he's discovered the prophecy, or if he's the only one who remembers it, or the only one who is thinking to apply it, or whatever, nevertheless, he seems to be the one who is saying, "Look, people, we've got good reason to think. You know, I'm going to make a confident prediction that disaster is going to come if the Mountain King returns to the mountain." Again, there's so much in there that has changed from the book, but it's there. You know, Robert Brown puts it really well. He says, "Subtext has become text." And yeah, that's one of the things that I think you see. It's one of the things that almost has to happen when you're doing a film adaptation of a book. You can't do the same kinds of things with subtext that you can. It's not that you can never do any subtext in a film, but many of the things which can be you know, implied or manipulated through the narrator character and things like that are things that you just can't do in a film. Anyway, I think that it's interesting to see those things. So again, it's another example to me of a moment when they're making some major changes from the book, and yet in doing those changes, they're preserving several elements which are really important to the books. So even as they're making a change in a sense within some of the framework of what the book is doing. And again, that's exactly what, to me, I did not see them doing in The Lord of the Rings. You know, I think about the, you know, to give a counterexample, since I was just doing, you know, I've just been thinking about the Battle of Pelennor Fields for the Return of the King class that I'm doing. The bringing of the army of the dead to the Battle of Pelennor Fields. That's a change, a radical change from the book, but I don't think that that is one that does this same kind of thing. I don't see anything being preserved there exactly. The one thing that you could say is being preserved is the eucatastrophic arrival of Aragorn to the field of battle. But even that, I feel is more undermined than emphasized by the use of the armies of the dead at the battlefield. Anyway, it's not clear. In the same way that, you know, Bard, the grim-voiced prophet of doom, is being preserved here, and the way that prophetic songs are being preserved, I don't see any similar elements being preserved in, you know, in that particular change to the Battle of Pelennor Field. My point is, this is where I think we can see an appreciably different approach to the books in the Hobbit films than was taken in the Lord of the Rings films. And that's why, no matter what the changes are, I respect more the adaptation work that Jackson is doing with the Hobbit films than with the Lord of the Rings films.
One thing I just want to point out before you move on from this is, boy, those onion hats sure do stand out in a crowd, don't they?
Boy, they do. They do. But in the best possible way, I'm telling you. Yeah, and I think next year for Halloween, I want to be a Lake Town guard. I totally, totally want one of those hats.
You and your sons, that would be cool.
Yeah, yeah, we can all be Lake Town guards.
Or your sons could be dwarves, and you could be a Lake Town guard.
Look at that.
You figure that's a tapestry. And those are bard's hands, aren't they? Or do we know for sure?
Yeah, they probably are. Yeah, the furry cuffs suggested. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, no, it's... So, and this actually, see, Dave, I'm right. He is discovering something, right? He's going and he's uncovering, look, here's a, you know, like old records and relics from Dale of the older time. And here's the, you know, the family tree. This must be him discovering, hey, those random dwarves I picked up, you know, this guy is Thorin. He's the king under the mountain. Wait, wasn't there a prophecy or something? Let me look that up.
Let me look that up on that tapestry.
Let me consult the tapestry. This stuff. This right here is the only scene of these ones at the beginning. We've seen this stuff before. Bard right. Steering the boat. Bard drawing his bow with the see-through arrowhead. We haven't seen this scene of them in the webs, but it's. Not anything totally new.
We've seen similar scenes.
Bilbo finding the ring and being apparently very relieved that he found it. That now we get the sequence. Though again, I love the way that in this trailer I think was not as well put together as the previous one, but it would have been hard to top that one, I think. In this one we get the Lord of Silver Fountains said in the background while we get a shot of Thranduil's throne, which I quite like. Both with the references in the book to Thranduil's fondness for silver and white gems, but also the way that it is kind of inviting us to juxtapose Thranduil and King Under the Mountain, you know, because of course he is also a king who's under, well, not a mountain but a forest. But anyway, so we've got, you know, the way that we get the visual juxtaposition here of. You know, while that prophecy is going on in the background, we get Thranduil, Thorin looking kingly, returning to the mountain, Thorin's position on the tapestry, and then Smaug. So we've got Thranduil, Thorin, Smaug in rapid succession as he's reading the much more cheerful first stanza of the prophecy that talks about the, just the return of the Mountain King. So that I think is interesting and pretty well done. Okay, we're returning to the mountain again. We've seen this before. We've got we've talked about Bard's prophecies.
This, backwards?
Yeah, I'm going forwards again now. I went back and now I'm going forward. So
you're
here,
fun.
here are the dwarves going under guard. Right, they're being marched in under guard. This is presumably Bard in the front, I guess. I don't know. Anyway, then we get Bard and his daughters. Let's hope his daughters survive. Gandalf.
Oh, now this is one that got me.
Yes.
Gandalf has got a big old head injury.
Yeah, so
it's
this
like a fraction of a second, but it's like.
And it looks like he's behind bars there, or at least he's on the other side of bars.
He's got a big bloody injury on his head.
Yeah. And.
That's just weird lighting.
And the context. I mean, listen to the words that they're juxtaposing this image of him with.
But all shall fail in sadness.
All shall fail in sadness, Gandalf's face.
Mm-hmm.
You know, connecting, again, inviting us to connect the concept of sadness and failure with Gandalf. I don't know whether that's to suggest that, you know, Gandalf is, you know, who doesn't look real happy in this particular moment. You know, sort of Gandalf's own sadness or Gandalf's own prophecies of doom or Gandalf's own fears about everything failing when he discovers, oh my goodness, this is really Sauron. We're actually in really huge trouble here. I don't know. I think that's a really interesting little glimpse. Then, of course, we get the ominous foreshadowing of the lake shining and burning.
Well, that's all they meant. It would just be a nice sunset.
Juxtaposed with the flaming eye. Not with Smaug, but with the flaming eye. Now, of course, that's probably just a play on burning. But again, notice how even in the trailer here, we're being invited to juxtapose Smaug and Sauron with the burning. You know, as the explicit reference, you know, while the song is explicitly referring to the burning by Sauron, or by Smaug, rather, we get an image, a visual image of Sauron. So that's kind of interesting. Okay, now we have his reaction, you shouldn't go in, you don't have any right, yes I do. The desolation of Smaug, right, here we are, Balin explaining. So we get the same scene, but more of it. This is... Do we have half the party here, or the whole party?
Well, we can only see half of them.
Yeah.
Let's see. Do we see Balin in here?
Balin's
here.
Yeah, because he's right there.
Well, he's Dwalin. Here, but he wasn't in that other shot. So.
Yeah, Balin and Dwalin. And
why would they have taken Biffer with them? You'd think they'd leave, if they're going to leave somebody behind, it would be Biffer.
Right.
Like, I think we're just getting partial shots of the company. Like,
yeah.
There's Dory. I see Dory in that shot.
Yeah, Dory here and Nori here.
And I see, and I think that is at the far end, that might be Beaufort.
Over here?
Yeah.
The two shots don't perfectly overlap.
No, they don't.
So I don't think we shouldn't read too much into it.
Desolation of the Dragon, and then he's going into the Horde. We've got the key, right?
So we've got the key given up on the main entrance, or...
And notice we have some more dwarves here. We have Ori next to Dori.
Yeah.
I think that's Nori there, too. Who's this? Who's this one?
I'm thinking that's probably Glowin, isn't it?
The only people we seem to be missing are...
Feely and Keely.
Feely and Keely.
Yeah. And I don't see...
Bifur?
Beaufort.
Yeah, Bifur is one with the axe in his head. Beaufort, okay, right. Yeah, Beaufort. Beaufort and Feely and Keely.
Bifur because of bifurcated.
Right. bifurcated his head.
I am tremendously confused about the sequence events about the mountain. We're going to have to get into it.
But yeah.
How do we go back and forth between the front door thing where they're having flames thrown at them to sneaking in? Actually, you know what? Here's my guess. I'm going to speculate. I think they are going to go directly to the secret door. I think they're going to sneak in through that. I think what's going to happen is the dwarves are going to go deeper into the mountain than they do in the book. Bilbo is going to wake up the dragon, and then they're going to run, escape out the front door. Otherwise, it just makes no sense that they would try to go in through the front, provoke the dragon, and then sneak up to the front, to the secret door. And all this time, Smaug is doing what?
So, right.
I suspect entrance through the secret door, and then the dwarves fan out through the mountain. Bilbo encounters Smaug, wakes him up, pisses him off, and then everybody has to run, and they run out to the Balin's balcony.
To Balin's balcony, yeah.
Yeah, and then eventually Smaug exits the mountain and flies away, and then they go back in.
I can see this. You know, one thing that I would not expect is for them to do like in the book and send Bilbo down alone while they just hang out. I can't see Thorin. I can't see movie Thorin being like, okay, doors open to my kingdom. I'm just going to sit here. You go in. I don't think is very likely at all.
No. Yeah. No. There's no hope.
So yeah. No. Hey, maybe. Maybe.
Otherwise, them trying to go in through the front door. It makes no sense. I don't know why they would do that.
Okay.
And I certainly don't know how they would have time to wander up to the secret door while Smaug is apparently awake and attacking.
Right. Do you have any explanation of this?
The dwarf never be king.
Who's he?
Well,
why is he so confident about this?
Well, here's the thing, Corey. How much do you want to know? Because I can give you an explanation of this from the spoilers attached to the 20 minutes of footage.
No, I don't want to know that.
Yeah, all right. Then we shouldn't answer it.
Okay. So don't answer me. Let me see.
I will tell you it's very interesting.
Yeah.
But it'll be more interesting to discover through the film, I think.
Okay, let's see.
But I'm
staring into the creepy eyes of this orc.
Yeah, needless. I will give you this. These tidbits. They capture this orc. He seems to be the pattern with the orcs in the films and stuff. Seems to have a penchant for saying more than he really ought to.
Yeah.
About what's going on. He just goes into monologue mode. This also the scene that we've seen in the video log of Tauriel saying, you know, oh, you want death? Let me give it to you.
Right.
That is also from here.
Yeah. And I'm guessing this is Tauriel leaving right after she's been dismissed. Yeah.
So anyway, but they're not major spoilers, but there's very interesting stuff from the scene. But it's stuff that you probably are happy you're not knowing. Not in the sense that it's bad, but it's it will reduce the surprise and interesting enjoyment of the film. But
all right, I need to log a protest here. We have never, ever, ever at Riddles in the Dark been barred from discussing something. I want to protest this. I don't know that having Corey decide not to read the spoiler is equal to. We're not allowed to talk about it.
Well, we can talk about it, but we can't talk about it with Corey.
Yeah, I'd just rather you didn't. That's all.
I mean, if you want to.
Well, I hadn't heard the explicit request, and it's
no, it's true.
Because, I mean, there are definitely pieces of it that I think are interesting tie-ins to the book that now we're not allowed to even discuss.
Yeah, but you know, but the thing is that. So I'm willing. I sort of get what you're saying. But I think they'll be interesting to discuss after seeing the film.
I understand.
I don't think that they're.
I don't agree.
They're interesting. They are interesting to think about, but I think they'll still be interesting to think about after the film.
I'm glad that you're lodging your opinion, but I don't know that your opinion now needs to become the rule. I appreciate that, and I just want to disagree respectfully with my learned colleague and say that actually I think there are some interesting pieces that are worth speculating. I mean, we've been speculating on stuff out of the trailer, think it's equally...
But I do think the overriding principle is we don't force people to listen to or discuss things that they'd rather not. So, you know, like if you're like, no, we totally got to get on record with this stuff, then I think like, hey, and Laura's on board or whatever, then like we should do a separate episode. But if Corey's like, I'd really rather not know, then we can't compel him to discuss it against his will.
Here's my thought. First of all, I wanted to clarify something. Robert was saying that he said, I thought spoilers didn't diminish a good story, which I've said many times before. Yeah, that's not my concern. My concern is not that the story is going to be ruined if I know in advance. My concern is primarily with the mechanism of knowing in advance. That is to say, if Peter Jackson were releasing that 20 minutes of footage for public viewing, I would watch it. And I wouldn't care about watching it. I would enjoy watching it, and I'd enjoy talking about it. What I don't enjoy talking about as much is somebody's written account of the 20 minutes of film. We've done that one time before with the CinemaCon thing back in season one. And that was okay, mostly because we didn't have we had so little to talk about then, that I didn't mind bringing that, though, you know, we were both, Dave and I were very, sort of dubious about a bunch of the things that were being discussed in that description. Here, my resistance, again, is not to knowing spoilers per se. It's not like, I mean, I'm not going to refuse to watch trailers or anything like that because I don't want to know in advance. It's the, my biggest problem with it is that when somebody says, okay, I've seen this stuff, this is what happens in the movie, that feels like information when I don't feel that we have information, or rather it will tend to be made into more information than it is. Because what we're getting is one person's version, one person's description, and one person's interpretation of what he has seen. And that is basically my biggest problem is that is not that I don't, that I want less data. It's that I want good data, and I don't consider that good data. I consider that bad data, or at least very potentially misleading data.
All you people that are complaining, all you got to do is track down a bootleg copy of the actual footage, and we will discuss it from now until Doomsday. But if all we have to go on is this OneRing.net dude's like commentary riddled description of it, partial description of it, then Corey's.
I'm okay, uncomfortable.
Now, I'm gonna I have to put my foot down on this because of the fact that I have to defend everybody else is talking about what a wuss I am in always caving to the I'm not gonna cave here. I'm not saying we should go through the whole torn thing word by word. I agree. I don't want to do that. But to bar me from mentioning drunk elves in the Halls of the Elven King, I don't agree with that. It's like, you know, I'm allowed to say stuff that's in the extended edition. It's like, I think it's interesting because we've speculated on that in the past. Are they going to have drunk elves? Apparently they are. And there's more than one person saying that. Yeah. I think we can rely on that data. I am not going to, you know, cave on this just because, and I also think we need controversy in the Rules of the Dark. So I think we're going to have more listeners to this episode because I'm not allowing Dave. See, Dave tries to take over just by talking. He does the volume of words. You know, he just keeps talking and won't let you talk. I'm not going to let this one go by. But I do think, I do agree. I know. It usually works. I do agree that I don't want to go through the whole thing word for word. I agree because I think it's just lending way too much credence to that. But I do think there were some interesting pieces to it.
And you know, and basically, I would be willing to. Well, but I want to think about it more and process it more. I would be willing to discuss tidbits. That is tidbits in particular, tidbits that, you know, especially if you and Dave sort of are willing to agree that there are, you know, these sort of maximally objective tidbits, you know, stuff that is just, you know, a description of things that occur in the film. I'm less interested in, you know, here's like the story that we get. I don't want this other guy's version of the story. I want to see the film version of the story. But something like that. I mean, I agree with you, Trish. I don't really disagree. I don't object to knowing that elves get drunk. I find that interesting too, and because that is, as you say, something that we've speculated about. But yeah, I guess that's the reason why I don't plan to read the thing. Because it's not the story. It's his version of the story, and I don't know. Like I said, if we could see it, if I could actually get the footage, I'd talk about it. I wouldn't have any hesitation of watching the 20 minutes of footage. It's not exactly a spoiler issue per se. It's but like thinking in this scene, which has provoked this discussion again. See, to say, you know, like Dave, as you were saying, like when I was asking that question, you're like, well, if you want to know, I can tell you. Well, but how much of that do we know? How much do we know, in fact, of the backstory? Like, this guy's given the backstory. How much of that really was depicted in the 20 minutes? How much of it is what he has put together from that 20 minutes? What exactly do we get? I don't know. I mean, it's, you know, how much of his description? I don't know. Like I say, these are the questions that I'm...
I think we could distill out... so, like, for example, in the orc interrogation scene, I think we could distill out one line.
Yeah.
That I think is a word-for-word transcription of dialogue.
Okay.
That is very interesting. And then leave aside all the other...
commentary.
Crap where he's talking about Thranduil being a good cop and blah, blah, blah.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, that's nonsense. Right.
And
in my opinion, the only thing that's interesting in this scene is a single line. Like, the rest of it is just like, blah, whatever. I think there's one line that I think is interesting, and then the rest of it is just kind of window dressing.
And basically, Brent has just was sort of asking about, wanting to sort of talk more in detail about why the write-up is bad. One thing I would want to say, exactly, I don't necessarily, I'm not assuming that this guy's done a bad job. I'm also not assuming that his interpretation is inaccurate. I know it might sound like that, like I'm just looking down my nose at the interpretation done by this loser on thewondering.net. I'm not trying to say that at all. It may be that his analysis is totally insightful and spot on. Once I've seen the film myself, I might go back and read it and find that I completely agree with him. That's entirely possible. My problem is, I don't like reading interpretation before I've seen the primary text. That's what I don't like. And you know, even if it turns out to be interpretation that I agree with in advance, this is one reason why I never read introductions to books. I hate introductions to books.
Really?
Yes, I never read them. I sometimes go back and read them after I finish the book, but I never read them before I read the book.
What's your take on Tolkien's introduction to Lord of the Rings? Like,
the prologue? I think that he writes it very carefully in order to avoid doing that. Tolkien hated this too. I'm thinking of this is a very obscure text. Those of you who know Smith of Wootton Major may remember that the story Smith of Wootton Major emerged from an introduction. Tolkien was asked to write an introduction to George MacDonald's fairy tale story, The Golden Key. And so he was set to write the introduction, and as he was writing the introduction, he wanted to illustrate fairy and what it was like, and so he started telling this story about this special cake and everything, and then the story just kind of took on life of its own, and it became Smith of Wootton Major, and he never finished writing the introduction to George MacDonald's Golden Key, and it was never published. In Vroen Flieger's edition of Smith of Wootton Major, she gives the unfinished draft of the introduction to George MacDonald's Golden Key that Tolkien never finished. And that introduction is really fascinating. I love it, because he spends half of his draft of the introduction complaining about introductions and how much he hates them, and that he's writing one and really obviously really uncomfortable with writing it. And actually, I find that text just hilarious. But anyway, what he does in The Lord of the Rings, in the prologue of The Lord of the Rings, is emphatically not the kind of thing that I'm describing, which is interpretation of the story you haven't read yet. He doesn't do that. You know, he gives background stuff. He makes some references. He gives some things which are almost spoilers, or at least are heavy foreshadowings. You know, like when he foreshadows what happens with Merry and Pippin referring to Bolroar took being the tallest hobbit in record, except for two famous characters, but that will be dealt with later on in this book. You know, so there are things like that he does, but no, it's interpretation before I've seen the primary text. That's what bothers me. And again, and it's not necessarily a critique of the interpretation. I just dislike doing that. And that's why I never read introductions before I read the book. I always start a book at chapter one. And especially I'm talking about introductions written by other people. Because they always do interpretation. and I can't stand that. So, yeah.
Why do you think they usually? Why do you think? What is with? Why do people like to include introductions to books?
I don't know, and I think Tolkien's suggestion again that he makes this suggestion in that abortive introduction to the Golden Key. He says really things like this should come at the end of books, but I suppose publishers don't put them there because they think people won't read them, and so you know they want some kind of scholarly accompaniment or something to the text, and they you know something to, if somebody picks it up and looks at it, they want, here's this like excellent and famous scholar telling you why you should read this book and why this book is important and what's so good and so interesting about it. And sometimes you get, here's important information that might help you to understand some parts of the book better, but really you can't avoid, again, not just spoilers in the sense of learning what happens later on in the story, you get those too, but interpretation. And I find myself actively annoyed, like it drives me crazy reading somebody's interpretive claims about a story that I haven't read yet.
Well, you're very, you're positively Tolkien-esque, because I see what you're saying, like reading someone else's introduction gets into, it's similar to Tolkien's complaint about sort of the purposeful, willful domination of the author rather than the freedom of the reader to interpret. And an introduction by someone else where they prime you to a particular interpretation of the text is doing the same thing.
Yeah, and
biasing your reading of the thing.
Exactly, and that's not only, you know, maybe questionable or something, it's just rude. I mean, if the author wants to assert some kind of domination over the reader of his book, like, you might not agree with that, but at least, like, that's his prerogative anyway, you know?
Yeah.
But for a third person to come in and be like, before you read this book, let me tell you how, you know, let me tell you what you should see. You know, let me tell you how everything works and the meaning of everything so that as you're reading it, you can think of nothing beside what I've already told you. Like, that's just rude.
Or they give you some background on the author and how the book came to be, which steers you also in a direction Tolkien hates, which is interpreting the story through the lens of the author's personal history.
Right. Yeah.
That's interesting.
Make sure you're only thinking of the biography of the author.
Look where you've led us, Trish. In this fascinating discussion.
I know. Well, actually, I was going to bring it back to this review. I actually look at the Torn thing more like the Empire article, because I think the Empire article also includes some subjective author opinion that I pretty much didn't. You know, I didn't report it for that very reason, which is it wasn't germane. And so that's, you know, I'm looking at it the same way. It's like I could go through this Torn write-up and pull out those kinds of salient facts that have to do with things we've talked about in the past that are obviously not subjective but are actually a report of stuff and do something similar to the Empire. Because I think that's really, to me, more the parallel, is it's more of a subjective reporter's view as opposed to, you know, like an introduction.
Yes, and that's why, you know, Andy Higgins was just comparing it to opera reviews. Absolutely, Andy, all reviews. I hate reviews. I never read reviews. I never, ever, ever read reviews. And if I ever happen to find myself accidentally afflicted with somebody's review, against my will or without my knowledge, it makes me more stubborn than ever, especially if somebody hates something. And that makes me want to see something twice as much.
Right, me too. Yeah.
But more than that...
How many times has that bit you, where you've gone and you've been like, yep, that was bad.
But at least I decided it was bad.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Exactly. But the thing is, I find, like, more than that, I just find them irrelevant. I mean, it's like, why would I take your word for this?
Right.
Like, you know, so this is your judgment. This is what you say, but you know, you've seen this and you come to these conclusions. Well, okay. But what on earth does that have to do with the question of, should I see the movie? I mean, it's like, I mean, I may end up agreeing with your conclusions, but you know, I still reserve the right to draw my own freaking conclusions about the thing on my own. You know, I mean, the whole concept, the whole project of writing reviews of something, you know, of telling people in advance, like, frankly, this is what literary what literary criticism was originally. Like, that's the origin of literary criticism, is like 18th century literary magazines, which like basically tell people, here are the virtues that you should look for in a book, and here are, you know, books that are good that you should read, and books that aren't worth your time. And basically that's, you know, now you've got these people, you know, film reviewers and art critics and restaurant critics and everybody else who want to go around and just tell us, and we're supposed to accept it like sheep, what's good and what's bad and what's worth, you know, what's worth watching and what isn't worth watching. And it just, the whole thing annoys me. I am so annoyed by reviews for exactly these reasons.
I love listening to Corey on a rant. It's so much fun. You ride a Tom Shippey in the rant.
Yeah, I gotta get a better accent though.
First tune in for.
Yeah,
that's right. That's what I said. I said, "Little controversy is good." Well, this will be probably one of our most listened to Riddles in the Dark. Listen to Dave and Trish fight. Yay!
Yeah,
we'll tell you what, Corey. Here's what we'll do for you, buddy. Trish and I will go through the article, and we'll just pull out every piece of information, every tidbit from the write-up that we agree unanimously, definitely not the guy's opinion or interpretation of what's on screen, but is him directly reporting, here's what a character said, here's what a character did.
Okay.
Not even things like, you know, Legolas looks upset about this. Nope, that's
right. Nope, okay. Nope, absolutely not.
Okay. Pull out straight dialogue,
okay,
or descriptions of events on screen.
Perfectly fair. And I love this plan because it also gives me the opportunity to complain loudly if you guys are wrong afterwards. So, like, if we actually see the film and any of the things you agree on don't happen or are incorrect, then I can rant again. So I love this. I love this.
Oh,
a win-win
situation. I think that's a deal. All right. It's a deal.
Win-win situation. Yeah, yeah.
Where were we?
Okay, trailer. Hey, there's a trailer going on.
Oh, that's right.
I really hate Rotten Tomatoes, Corey.
I never look at it.
Here.
I never look at it.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, I have no interest in it.
And of course, I have the complete opposite situation going on. Teresa will refuse to go to see any movie that has less than 70%.
Oh, my goodness.
Well, see, I don't know. I mean, I guess... It's difficult. I mean, you know, some people are saying, you know, that, you know, critics can be good for like keeping you from wasting your time. I guess, again, I don't agree. Like, I don't even consider watching a bad movie a waste of time. There's always interest. There's always something to be learned. Even if you get nothing but amused mockery out of it, that's still something. I guess I don't feel like my time has ever completely been wasted in watching a film or doing something like that. I mean, any more than I would consider my time wasted if I went to an exhibit of paintings that I disliked. I wouldn't consider that. I might not have enjoyed myself, but I wouldn't consider it a waste of time. You know, it was still interesting. You know, to come into contact with even with a poor performance. I mean, I still learned. I feel like I still learned something from watching that. Or I don't know. The one thing, I guess, let's see, Brianna is defending reviews and critiques of video games. Brianna, I would agree to the extent that if somebody says the game just doesn't work properly, I mean, if there are like technical problems or like the gameplay is really, really, really boring for reasons that they can point to, I'm kind of interested in that.
Such as absence of a you catastrophe button.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. But yeah, I mean, as far as the, but I do treat, even with video games.
Robert Brown wants to know if you look at your own reviews.
Yeah, sure. I do. Mostly, not all of them. I mean, I don't hunt for them, but there I am interested for a totally different reason. Because I'm not any longer shopping for a book. That book I already know. So I am interested to hear what other people's responses have been. I will definitely look at reviews there. But because, again, it's a totally different situation. But no, I would never read reviews of a book that I'm interested in reading. Anyway.
Okay, so let's see.
Okay, trailer. There was a trailer going on.
Trailer going on.
Let me.
Well, everybody's really getting their money's worth, and we've actually retained still most of our audience.
Oh boy, we're going to be mocked on YouTube again. So anyway, but we're going to accelerate here. There was only one other piece of voiceover that I was really interested in this trailer, which we'll get to later on. But I want to mostly kind of skim through the visuals here. The last comment I want to make about this before you guys peel back the curtain and tell me later on the true story of everything that's occurring, I would just say the one clear piece of evidence from that one line delivered by Mr. Creepy-Eyed Goblin here is that there's obviously some kind of greater knowledge and probably coordination among the enemy troops than was obvious in the first film. In the first film, we got Azog on a mission, which, by all evidence presented to us in film one, was a personal vendetta, merely a personal vendetta. And that he didn't even necessarily care about who Thorin was, other than who he was for their own personal history. The fact that he may or may not be the king under the mountain in Erebor, it was not obvious that that entered into Azog's calculation. He was like the dude who chopped my arm off. And that's really what Azog appeared to care about in film one. Similarly, the references to Azog by the Goblin King, by the Great Goblin, rather, in film one, suggested a familiarity, but not real coordination. Like, he's heard rumors about, you know, that Azog is going around and that he's hunting for Thorin, but it did not necessarily imply that they were working together or coordinating in any way. The fact that we get a goblin here who is talking about Thorin and his return to the mountain and making sort of threatening, or I was going to say prophetic, or at least threatening remarks about that, does suggest that there's some kind of at least knowledge, if not coordination. So that's the one thing that I would say based upon only this trailer. Now, again, just looking at the visuals. Oh, look, it's Azog jumping up on the parapet for the third time. We now have a 100% Azog jumping up on the parapet and a 100% shooting from branches down into barrels.
They really made use of their library of clips, didn't they?
Yep, now we've got Legos sheathing his thing. Again, now we've got This Is Not Our Fight. Yes, it is again. The same Mirkwood shot we've seen before. Thorin being threatened
that looks like he's
with Orcrist. Yeah. Maybe it is Legolas's hand in that poster, Dave. because this seems to be the moment when Orcrist is taken from him, I would guess. Right after the spiders, we're still all covered in cobwebs. So this implies to me here that the rescue scene that we see of Legolas and Tauriel coming and rescuing the dwarves is going to end confrontationally between them. Which is kind of interesting.
He's wearing armor in that scene, too.
Yes. Yeah. Okay, so yeah, we live in this world, and now we're climbing. We get more shots of the stairs and the colossal dwarf statue, which is cool.
I love that. Oh, we live in this world.
And it's, who's that? Nori's hair? Nori looking at
the
profile of the statue of the dwarf, yeah.
Yeah, it looks like Nori, yeah.
Looking at the mountain and saying, is my nose really that big? Actually, I think, now that I live in New Hampshire again, I think this is like an homage to the Old Man of the Mountain here. You know, I think this is like in memoriam of the Old Man in the Mountain. It's the old dwarf in the mountain. Okay, so we're going to give you the quotation from trailer one, but we're going to complete the sentence and say it's the Arkenstone appearing radially at the center of these rays here. As I see how obviously significant it is the center of the whole thing. Bilbo curiously asking, "What's that?"
I just said this to who was it? Somebody, Vime, I think it was, in the question. I don't. The thing I got about the big deal they're making about the Arkenstone now, I'm confused, because in the prologue, in An Unexpected Journey, they say, you know, they found the Arkenstone, the heart of the mountain, and basically they say that Tror uses the Arkenstone as a justification for his rule. He doesn't. It doesn't say he who has it gets to be king. It's more like he uses it as a justification. So now it's all of a sudden taken on this huge, you know, thing. I don't understand.
Right. Well, that's my big question. Is its significance symbolic or actual? Like, is it magical or is it just a really important symbol? And saying that it's merely symbolic, of course, is not to say that it isn't really important. Symbols are very important. And if everybody agrees that the symbol is important, then it's important. But the way that it's being discussed in the trailers for the second film are leading me to wonder, is there actually some kind of magical potency or other that it that it's supposed to have? Here is, we got the attitude of Thorin towards Bilbo here.
What's that?
That, Master Burglar, is why you are here.
Badass Thorin.
Yeah. He's looking pretty threatening here. You kind of wonder, like, has Bilbo already run over Thorin's dog or something? Like, what is it exactly that has... I mean, because we've talked about this. We've done whole episodes on the Thorin-Bilbo relationship. And I have to say that I have not found the trailers very illuminating on that question so far. I mean, yes, we see that Thorin is going to become antagonistic to Bilbo. We all knew that would happen sooner or later. But the questions we've been asking about, how does this come about? What is it that leads to this conflict? I don't feel like we've gotten anything on that yet. I mean, what do you guys think? Am I missing something?
No, I think you're right. It's kind of digital, you know? We go from a hug to a, you know, you're scum.
Right. Yeah, I mean, Andrew says dragon sickness. Yeah, I mean, I do imagine that this is going to be a kind of index of how far corrupted Thorin is. But still, there's got to be some pretext, right?
Now, I do think there's a flash of a scene. I don't know if we've gotten to it yet, where Balin is saying, "I'm worried about you." And I think I'm assuming he's talking to Thorin.
Yes, me too. Flash of the scene. Me too, yeah. And we're going to get that. That's not here. Now, this is Balin being like, "I am showing solidarity to Bilbo."
Right.
Yeah. Okay, right. Stuff we. This I keep questioning.
That guy's not identified as Girion, by the way.
And the more I think about it, the more it's... we got to be careful drawing conclusions like this from trailers. The more they keep integrating this clip, the less it looks like a flashback to me.
It is in the extended edition movie. Yeah. UJ. Yeah. And I don't know why they have it in this trailer, because that scene of him with the ballista and the thing blowing up is in the extended edition.
Oh, okay. So it's just... weird.
I know. I thought that was kind of strange, too. Unless they're going to review it in the beginning of Desolation of Smaug.
Right.
To review, let's go back. If you didn't see the extended edition, let's just go back here.
Weird. Marketing people just shoved it in here.
Just shoved it in. Yeah.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, okay. So, yeah, we've got, like...
You must always beware of reading too much into a thing that's primarily designed to convince us to go to the movies.
Yes.
I was going to agree with you, because I thought you were going to say, you must always beware of marketing people. And I was going to say, yes, absolutely.
Yes. Beware of marketing people. Yes.
That's right.
Okay, so we've got the barrels with nobody wearing proper safety equipment, as we've seen before, and Thorin swinging some kind of orc weapon in a very violent manner, while Kiwi, who still does not quite yet look injured, though looks slightly manic, fires off his bow, which he has somewhere acquired, I don't know where. And then we've got Toriel.
Oh, Bilbo's in the water. I didn't see. Did you notice Bilbo was in the water by Keely there?
Yep.
Oh, yeah, that is his head, right. So, yeah, so he's clinging onto Keely's barrel. And then we have air traffic control cleared for landing. And Bilbo.
The Karate Kid Toriel.
Yeah.
I like the juxtaposition of those two scenes, because it looks like he's looking at her.
Right, exactly. Uh-oh, here she comes. So, Here's Bilbo looking up at Mirkwood. We saw this in trailer number two. Trailer number two shot of the canopy of Mirkwood.
Right?
Yeah. Now, here's, okay, new shot. Gandalf and Radagast.
The world is in grave danger.
Radagast, getting all senior statesman-like here, you know. Yeah, this is not your ridiculous Radagast there. But anyway, just go the quick look at the visuals. Spider pouncing on Bilbo and him falling like we saw in number two. Legolas fighting in Lake Town as we saw in number two. Toriel and Orc in woods as we saw also. This is the same shot we saw where he's using his two knives and not Orcrist. This is hopefully Pointing Elf, who also is blows horns
elf.
Too. Yes.
I blow too.
Yes,
point,
he's perhaps we should change his name to Notification Elf. I don't know.
Alert Elf.
Yes. This is just him pointing in a broader radius, basically.
Right.
I guess this is Elros, maybe?
Oh. That's right. Because we've been wondering who would be.
Yeah. Get the name Elros. Okay, Dol Guldur, yeah.
Snap before.
Radagast being all senior statesman-like, the spider climbing up the back of the tree.
Seen this before.
Okay, now, look at the mountains in the background there. Look at the peaks, the ruins.
Looks like Dol Guldur.
Gundabad.
You're thinking it's a...
Well, see, it's still not... This is really...
It's not mountainous enough. If you look at the scene with the orcs, like, you can see mountains-ish.
Yeah, over here. I mean, it could just be angle and mist.
I think it's, I'm going for,
Gundabad. Yeah. Okay, and so there we get him going across another narrow bridge, which we know Gandalf is frightfully keen on.
I've seen that before.
Yeah, we did. It's trailer two. Now we get...
okay, here's the scene.
Here's the scene.
For you. If this is to end in fire.
Okay, hang on a second.
Oh, and I swear that's the thrush. Sharon thinks it might be the arrow. But I think it's a bird.
What that looks like is a ballista fired from...
Oh my gosh, now it does, doesn't it? I swear I thought I saw it. Wings flapping.
I believe that this is more extended edition Dale footage that is not actually a part of this movie. That's Dale. That's not Lake Town.
Yeah,
there's
you're right.
Stone structures there.
Yeah. So here's the dragon flying over, and then I'm playing it forwards now. The thing flying up to hit him.
It does look like the ballista.
And that is the ballista down there.
Yeah, we've seen this before. Yeah, this is just the extended edition deal.
Oh, it is a ballista. Yeah, there it is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yep. That is a foreshortened ballista bolt, it does seem.
That is a ballista, right? That's not an arrow.
It's like the four-armed ballista thing that we saw in the other shot. Okay.
Now, interestingly enough, that scene's not in the extended edition, so it makes me wonder if maybe there's going to be a prologue where they replay that scene.
A super extended edition.
Together.
Okay, well, I want to go back here because we're all burning together and I'm not understanding. Let's see.
If this is to end in fire, then we will all burn together.
If this is to end in fire, then we will all burn together. Okay, so what he's stating here is a strongly anti-self-sacrificial outlook. Like, I don't know.
I wonder if they're arguing before that.
Yeah. Here's Bilbo having dropped the ring, apparently, before he recovers it and is very grateful. If he can spot it in the dark from that far away, hobbits have very sharp eyes indeed.
This definitely made me think of the whole ring abandoning its wearer thing.
Yeah. What is this? The Arkenstone?
That's when they visit the tomb of the Nazgul.
Yeah, it does look like Gandalf's staff light.
Yeah, and it's the broken. We've seen this before.
Oh, actually. Yeah, this is the broken bars. Yeah, I see. Yeah. I was missing that. I was just focusing on this and missing the framework there. Yeah, it's the broken bars. Yeah, so that would be Gandalf and Radagast at the tomb. Okay. And here's her, the duck maneuver.
That's, we've seen that a zillion times, right?
Yeah. Okay, we haven't seen that exact spider shot. We get elves drawing weapons. We get Gandalf about to whack the eye, as we saw before. Bjorn coming out of the woods. We see a little bit more of him this time than we did before. Bilbo
falling in the water.
Falling through the gates into the water.
Right. Yes.
Like a log, for some reason.
Yes, for some reason, I don't...
That is not a safe way to dive.
Yeah, definitely not.
Well, we actually know why that happens, but Dave and I have to prepare that for you.
He's just too amazed me. The courage of hobbits.
So that's definitely a cup that he's holding there,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, that made me happy. I don't know why.
I don't understand is how Balin is generalizing, making general statements about the courage of hobbits when he has direct experience of one.
Yeah.
I had the same thought. I'm like, God, Balin, you're really stretching here.
The courage of hobbits. This is the first hobbit you have ever met.
I know. I had that same thought.
Well,
it's not like hobbits are well... It's not like, yeah, sure, I haven't met any hobbits, but I've heard about these other courageous hobbits. No.
I know.
Yeah. Yes. The legends of courageous hobbits are clearly well justified. I see. Yeah,
I feel like that's a line that is. I feel like this is another one of those weird sort of playing fast and loose with the order of the films type thing.
Or like Sharon says, Balin's taking Gandalf's line.
Yeah. Right,
they're leveraging the fact that we have already seen films with surprisingly courageous hobbits in it before, even though Balin hasn't.
Yeah.
So it's an attempt to remind us of the films we've already watched.
Yes. Yeah.
Just in case we've already paid for a ticket, we're sitting in this film and we're still not convinced, and what they're doing is subliminally reminding us of the other films that we liked.
That there are more courageous hobbits to come.
Yeah. That we've already seen.
Yeah. By the way,
it's just like
I would like to
comes a point where it's like, I've already paid to see this film, you don't need to remind me of the other films.
One thing that I missed a few minutes ago, I want to just go back to mention briefly. Benedict has said maybe about the flying ballista bolt that we were looking at. Maybe a ballista wounds Smaug, and that's the point that Bilbo spots, and the one Bard later uses to kill Smaug.
Interesting.
That the gap in his armor is actually a scar left from a previous wound that he received.
That is brilliant.
That's a very good theory. I like it.
Benedict, I like it too. It's the one thing it seems difficult to reconcile is with Smaug marching through the gates of, you know, blowing down the gates of Erebor and coming in, which is presumably after he's destroyed Dale, based on what the sequence we got in the prologue scene. He didn't look like he was sporting a major ballista wound at that point, but maybe he was. You know, maybe we just didn't see it. Maybe, you know, Smaug was just playing through the pain.
Well, maybe it was a small thing and it festered later, you know.
Exactly. That would be an excellent heroic touch. Unfortunately, Smaug's womb got septic later on. And Jan does point out injured animals are extremely dangerous. That's true. Maybe the ballista wound in his side is what really threw him over the top, and he totally trashed Erebor. Ed has.
I think it's too bad Jackson and his team don't listen to our podcast. They're very funny.
Ed has a really interesting comment, which I think is very insightful. Ed says, "Occasionally, Philippa Boyens understands good dialogue. She just doesn't care who speaks it." I agree. From my first viewing of the Fellowship of the Ring, that sense of like, I'm having surreal out-of-body experience hearing one character deliver another character's lines at a different time. That does seem to be entirely accurate. Kieran asks, isn't that scene in the extended edition and we see the ballista just bounce off of Smaug's scales?
I was just answering Kieran and said, you know, it might be you should always take what I say. You know, you should always question what I say when I assert things like that. Because I could have turned my head for a moment and I would have not seen that scene.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Well, let's see. Let's see. We're still planning to discuss the extended edition. We'll probably do that in the next episode. So we'll definitely come back to this.
So that's something we need to make note of, that when we all watch it again, just, you know, look for that scene.
Right. Okay. Avalanche of Treasure. One thing here, we've seen this shot, but does... Okay, and I was wondering what this thing is. It looked like something like Bilbo was gets thrown off. There's something large. It's just something big. Okay, this thing. I wanted to slow it down and see what this thing was, because it looked like, you know, you get gold coins scattering everywhere and one larger object tossed off to the side, and I was wondering if that might actually be Bilbo, but it looks like it's not.
Or the Arkenstone.
Yeah, presumably not. Though when last we saw the Arkenstone, it was disappearing into a maelstrom of gold coins, right?
That's right.
Here, let's get Benedict Cumberbatch's entire line, yeah.
I am king under the mountain.
Now, Dave, do I understand properly that people were objecting to this line? Like on Facebook, you were mentioning before, I think.
I can't remember what they were saying.
I think you said something about that somebody was saying that Smaug was saying that because he had the Arkenstone. I don't think that's true. Yeah, I think that's Smaug. Smaug's like basically saying, hey, I'm bad and I'm king.
Yeah, people are just sort of doing their usual, the usual thing of reading way too, you know, like wild speculation of like, oh, maybe, you know, we've been talking about how the Arkenstone bestows upon someone kingship. Maybe Smaug's saying that he's got it or whatever. And it's like, I think he's just making an ironical statement, like, you know, Thorin's not king under the mountain. I am. I'm
unbeatable.
Like,
I'm
in the mountain, guys. Just right. I don't know if you noticed. I'm here. I'm in charge of things right now. So if there's a king under the mountain, it's me.
Yeah, I mean, and that's
right. Exactly.
That's, and he does that in the book. He says that in the book at the end of chapter 12. They shall see me. He's talking about the lake men, of course. They shall see me and remember who is the real king under the mountain, says Smaug. That's so right. I mean, yeah, that's totally, like, that line seems to me totally uncontroversial for that reason.
Well, I mean, people like it's. Speculating wildly is what makes all of this fun. So
yeah,
of course people are going to do that. So I don't,
of course, we're above that. So
yeah, well, fine. Yeah,
we speculate, but not wildly.
Goes without saying.
Nobody here engages in that sort of behavior, but yes, everything we say is founded in fact.
Exactly.
We're just not wild about it.
Yeah, exactly.
I wonder what they're doing, though. I wonder if perhaps there's going to be a great, like, so Smaug is really never, the extent to which he is aware of what's going on in the book is he smells some dwarves. He smells Bilbo, whatever Bilbo is. He suspects the lake men are fooling with him, etc. I kind of wonder if they're going to make it a little more personal, like if he actually understands that he is under assault from uppity dwarves attempting to reclaim their homeland.
Yeah, I mean, he's, you know, there's the business where Bilbo says that they've come for revenge and he laughs at that. You know, that concept is present. Smaug's response, of course, is just to mock at it and saying, you know, where are the heirs of them, you know, who dare seek revenge. He's questioning their existence and questioning furthermore that they would even dare to try, even if they did exist.
I'm hoping that that we have at least some of the scene or some version of the scene where Smaug is trying to, you know, give Bilbo doubt, you know, where he's weaving his stuff about, you know, they're not going to keep their word to you, and Bilbo's starting to like have doubts. I hope they have something like that.
Yes, the sowing doubt against the dwarves thing. That would be really cool.
Right.
Yeah. Somebody help me. The one last thing I wanted to talk about in the trailer, and I know I missed it when I was just looking at the visuals. That moment where Gandalf gets the voiceover saying talking about killing the dragon, Does anyone recall where that is?
It's early on. We have a scene of the dwarves standing in a line, I think, at the near the front
gates. Before now.
Before now.
Before the end? Okay, that's good. Yeah, that's helpful.
Yeah, it's I think more toward the front. Right after. I think it's right after Bard does his recitation. Of
Dragon.
The...
That's it. Here
that's
we
it.
Are.
That's it, right there. Yep.
Yeah, okay. All right.
What is this place?
The desolation of Smaug.
Destroy the dragon. Take back your homeland.
Destroy the dragon. Take back your homeland. That's clearly Gandalf.
Yes.
Yes.
What is that supposed to be? His parting words? Like, okay, I gotta go.
I think it's his parting words, and again, back to the extended edition, we see a scene in the very end of the extended the extras. I think I mentioned this to you, Corey. We see Gandalf's on horseback, and he's saying to the company, stay to the path, stay to the path. And I think that they're at Bjorn's, and Bjorn's giving him a horse, and he's taken off for Dol Guldur, and he's giving, like, last instructions. And I'll bet that's when he says this.
And that's Gandalf's brilliant advice. Okay.
Yeah, that's right. Kill the dragon.
I have two pieces of advice to you. Destroy the dragon and take back your homeland. If you do that, you should be fine. It sort of reminds me of those, you know, having just finished watching the World Series with very great pleasure, of course. I can't forbear to mention.
Yeah. Did you show up in your jacket like you did before?
I actually forgot. I meant to do that on Thursday, but I forgot. But anyway, my point is, I'm sort of comparing it to the really, really dumb thing that TV announcers do at the beginning of sporting events, where back in the old days, they used to say, these are the keys to the game. And they used to actually consist of tactical or strategic points. Like, if this team manages to, like, counteract that particular threat, they will probably win. Instead, the keys to the game now always boil down to, their key to the game is to win. They need to win this game, preferably by scoring more points than the other team.
More points than the other team.
Yes. If they can manage to outscore the other team, I think they've got a good chance. And it's like, thank you. Thank you for that insightful analysis. And basically, that's what this seems like from Gandalf from me. Okay, I will send you off with these parting words. Destroy the dragon and take back your homeland.
Yes.
Okay.
Also, if possible, reclaim your treasure.
Yes, exactly. Yes. I've got some other things for your to-do list here, Thorin, just in case.
Because killed along the way.
Because you're so forgetful. You know, I just wanted you to keep your eyes focused, Thorin. You're so flighty, you know, and I want you to remind you it's about destroying the dragon and recovering your homeland. Come on now.
Have you guys considered the possibility that, in fact, this is an edited line, and what he was saying is, do you really think you're going to be able to just...
Yes! I was thinking that. That would be hilarious. Hilarious if they have reversed the context through sound editing. That will be one of the points where I will laugh out loud in the theater the first time I see it, if that in fact ends up happening.
Funny.
But yes, I was just thinking exactly the same thing, Dave, that would be hilarious, because it sounds, why would Gandalf say, I mean, it's hard for me to imagine the context, the immediate context of Gandalf saying something like that. It's just such a dumb thing to say by itself. Especially since destroy the dragon is the one thing they've never really had much of a chance of doing. So simply saying, go forth and destroy the dragon, Thorin, just seems, I don't know.
Yes.
I like to hear what Thorin's response to that is. You know, like, what does Thorin say right after Gandalf says that to him? Like, duh.
Right.
Do you have any more constructive feedback?
Yeah, exactly.
Destroy the dragon.
Erica says, were they ever trying to kill the dragon, or were they just trying to get the treasure back? In the book, they do talk about bringing their curses home to Smaug. I mean, that's present there in chapter one, but it's clear that it's the treasure they primarily want. Let's say, if you think about it, in the book, if they had to choose, you know, choose between a fight to the death against Smaug, in which they killed Smaug but themselves were lost or their treasure was lost, would that have been worth it? Or would they have rather managed to get all the treasure but Smaug escapes somehow? I mean, just imagining this were theoretically possible. which one of those things would they choose? You know, where is their, does their priority really lie? In chapter one of the book, no question, they'd like to see the dragon destroyed, but if they could take the treasure back and Smaug gets away, I think they'd clearly choose that rather than killing the dragon at the expense of losing the treasure and not having anything. That I can't see them doing. So, Erica, in that sense, you're right. In the book, I don't think it wasn't focused on killing the dragon. But that, I think, has been less true in the film, with a greater emphasis on vengeance. Especially, I'm thinking, of course, of that scene of, embittered, vengeful Thorin at his forge at the end of the prologue in film one. Yeah.
Now, I do want to go on record. I told Andy yesterday after we saw the sneak peek that, this a line of, if this is to end in fire, then we all burn together.
Yeah.
Armitage was asked during the streaming part of the live event yesterday, what was his favorite line? And Armitage, first of all, went through this thing about, well, I'm a Tolkien purist, and then immediately said this was his favorite line, which is kind of like, why did you even bother to say you're a Tolkien purist if this is the line that's your favorite line? And then I found out that actually this line, then I saw it in the trailer, and then I found out that this line is now going to become kind of like the line. Uh-huh. And I thought, here we are with marketers again.
Yeah, they probably prompted him to say that. Yep.
Yeah, it's like Armitage, okay, if somebody asks, or we're going to plant somebody to ask this question, and you say this is your favorite line, now I don't like it. So I want to let Andy know that I told him that I thought that was a cool line. I now don't think it's a cool line.
Hey, do you think that Armitage is clever enough to lead with that thing about being a Tolkien purist in order to undermine what he was about to say? Basically, him doing like a wink, wink, nudge, nudge at everybody else, saying like, don't believe what I'm about to tell you?
I hadn't given...
Because you're right, it makes no sense.
Especially if he'd been told that that's what he's to say. Oh, gosh.
So there's, yes, Armitage saying,
I'm
going to submit to the marching order, and I'm going to be a good soldier, and I'm going to say what I've been told to say, but I don't really like it, so I'm going to kind of tip my cap to people who... And the marketing people, yes, won't pick up on it, but... I don't know.
Yes, that might have been like his apology for saying that I kind of have to say this line here, but I want you guys to know I understand.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Of course, it's also possible that he's just clueless and actually thinks it's from the book, but.
No, that was what he was saying. It was like, even though I'm a Tolkien purist.
I see, right.
And I know this is not a line from Tolkien, this, yeah, is my favorite line. So now, actually, you saying that makes what he said make more sense.
Maybe. Anyway. It's a generous interpretation, but hey, it's fine. I don't mind. And by the way, that's another reason why I often don't like watching interviews with actors, because it makes it harder for me to... I prefer generous interpretations. So that's why I don't like to receive contrary evidence that undermines my generous interpretations. I would rather carry on giving somebody more credit than they deserve than find out that they don't really deserve it. So
yes. Well, I mean, another reason too is what I was just saying, which is, a lot of times they get set up. This is not a ad hoc, spontaneous,
right,
response.
Right.
This is one that the marketer set up for him to say, especially since it's in the trailer.
Yes.
And apparently part of something else that Dave and I will be letting you know later.
Right, exactly. Cool. Okay, well, we're 3 hours in now. It's time for the riddle, right?
Oh, gosh, yeah.
You think?
I hadn't... Dave, did you by any chance move it over onto our script?
Or do we have to dig it out of email?
I can get it out of email, okay. Because I was having a problem with my... But I've got it here. You want me to read it? Because I've got it right here in front of me.
Okay, sure. Go ahead.
What reason will film 2 give for Smaug's attacking and occupying Erebor? A, it will give no further explanation beyond the vague reference to wealth in film 1. B, and we've switched it. I noticed, Dave, you switched it. You're very smart. It will expand upon the idea that Smaug's actions are the typical dragon pursuit of hoarded wealth, which is actually the book answer.
It's our first non-A book answer ever.
It's our first non-A book answer ever. That's right. We're doing a lot of firsts this time. C, he has a special interest in and desire for the Arkhan Stone for whatever reason. D, he did it at the behest or command of Sauron. Very nice.
Yes, and as Dave you know, Dave, as you were pointing out when you constructed this riddle, it's one of those sort of cumulative riddles that any reference to anything further down the list, so if he is looking for hoarded wealth, but also specifically seeking the Arkenstone, the correct answer is C, and B is incorrect.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And if you did it at the behest of Sauron and all the other stuff applies too, D is correct.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So smart. You know, Dave, you do have those flashes. You do have those moments.
Robert suggests... Robert Brown says E. He was envious of the Dalemans' toys. That's actually the book answer. That's the real book answer right there. Yeah, yeah.
That's the real book answer right there.
Yeah, yeah.
All right.
Okay.
Oh, I should set these up. Let me go set this up. You want me to set this
up? Yeah, why don't you go ahead and quick do the poll while we think about it here.
Okay.
Okay. I think, A, unlikely that we're not going to get any reference to it. A real question, this would be like a little sub-riddle. Assuming the answer is not A, and we do in fact learn that, we do in fact learn more about Smaug's reasons for coming to the mountain, from whom do we learn Smaug's reasons for coming to the mountain? Who gives it to us? From Smaug? In the conversation from Thorin, do we get an extra flashback or something something that he's concluded from Thranduil, possibly, who was there and makes some remarks to Thorin about what was really going on that day?
That is a fascinating question.
From Gandalf?
That's a really good question. The only thing I can imagine would be, I mean, the sort of the thing that planted this in my mind was just the speculation about, oh, maybe Smaug has the Arkenstone, and sort of the central import being placed on that. And then also the confirmation by the filmmakers that they were going to get into the whole coordination between Smaug and the Necromancer.
Yeah.
But that brings up, that's a very good point. Like, okay, so who is going to explicate this on screen?
Yes.
And is it going to be, you know, are we going to get Smaug monologuing with Bilbo? Like, you know, well, I came here original. Let me tell you my story.
So, right.
I have this old friend. I haven't seen him in a while. His name was Sauron. He told me, he sort of, you know, we were having coffee one day, and he suggested, hey, you should go down and check out that Lonely Mountain. There's a lot of stuff there I think you can enjoy.
right.
It's kind of hard to imagine them getting into that. So how are they going to hint at the idea of coordination? And maybe it will be very subtle, in which case it probably won't be enough to actually indicate the.
I could easily imagine Smaug dropping something that would give attentive viewers clear evidence that he's coordinating with somebody else, or even that he's taking orders. I mean, I don't know. I don't know enough about how they're really going to do his character in the film.
I guess what you could imagine is maybe he might say something like, I was warned. I was warned that I might be seeing someone. You know, I was sent a message to keep an eye open for invaders. Something like that, like something very subtle that it's just like even just a throwaway comment that like you have not taken me at unawares. I've been expecting you.
Right.
Something like that would be like, aha, who would have told him? Must have been Sauron.
Right. Right. Yeah. Yeah. Sharon points out that the dwarves of Erebor becoming legendary for their wealth attracted the dragon. That's what says in the first film.
That is answer A.
That's answer A. If that's all we ever hear.
And that was my point, and that's why I specifically wrote the question to be, what will we be told in film 2?
Yes.
About this. And specifically, if they don't say anything about it whatsoever in film 2, then the answer is A, i.e. all we have to go on is
what was said in film
Fallen's story about dragons being attracted to the legendary wealth of Erebor. if in film two they follow up on that and we get more dwarves talking about, like, you know, yeah, Smaug came here for the treasure and stuff. If they confirm that and follow up on it, but they don't say anything that contradicts, you know, oh, it was just about the wealth. That would be B. C would be if Thorin or somebody specifically says, like, you know, Smaug took the Arkenstone and he's keeping it from me, something like that. And that might be C.
Yes.
Or Smaug specifically says something about the Arkenstone.
Yeah, yeah. Smaug's like, you know,
I've got your rock.
And it's probably not even enough that Smaug acknowledges the Arkenstone,
right,
and says he has it. He would have to say that, like, you know, and this is why I really came here.
Right. I heard, you know, rumors or legends of this stone, or exactly.
Yeah. And this was my true objective.
Right.
Just in case you were wondering, unknown, unseen burglar person.
Right. Or not unseen.
So it seems like there's a fairly high bar for C or D.
Yeah,
and they are maybe unlikely, but it's just interesting.
I would say Brianna makes a really good point. She says coordinating doesn't mean that the command of Sauron was his reason for coming. He could have decided to coordinate after settling in Erebor.
It would have to rise to the level of, my good friend Sauron and I were having coffee one day, and he specifically up in the northern wastelands before I came here, and he told me about this place, Erebor. If we get something like that, even if it's not Sauron commanded me to come, but if it's Sauron told me about Erebor, I hadn't heard about it before until Sauron told me, that's deep.
Or wait. Gandalf is sneaking around Dol Guldur, and he's standing with his back pressed against the wall around a corner while Sauron is talking to the Witch King, and Sauron says, "That's the most brilliant idea I had since I sent Smaug to Erebor."
Or the Witch King says, "Gee, boss, that was the best idea you had."
Yeah.
And Sauron says,
"This is
stop
another...
sucking up to me."
Yeah, this is another winner.
Yep. Or the Witch King grumbling, "Man, you sent Smaug to Erebor, and all I get is this lousy ruin."
That's right, the ruin. That's right.
Yeah.
That's
right. You left me to rot in the frickin' tomb.
Exactly.
That's right.
Exactly.
That's right.
Yep. See all these possibilities? All of these possibilities. Excellent. Okay, so yes, it's true. We could have direct evidence of coordination, as Brianna says, post-Erebor collaboration between them.
Yeah.
Which would still not mean the answer is D. It would have to be part of his reason to come. Sauron would have had to have some hand in some role to play in Smaug's arrival at Erebor. Yep. So yeah, I agree. The bar is really high for that. I'm not sure even I can talk myself into that one. So to me, I'm debating between B and C. I can't imagine it's never going to come up. I think it's going to come up. And you know, one place where I could see it coming up is dinner at Bjorn's house. That's where I could see it coming up from Gandalf. Gandalf sending them off, giving them a little, giving us the film viewers a little recap, and giving the dwarves, you know, final instructions and context. I could imagine Gandalf speechifying about Smaug and giving us a review at the beginning of the second film.
But telling us that he specifically came to Erebor for the Arkenstone?
Well, that's the question. Would that be included or not? And I think it's possible, though, depending on how early on, is it only going to be, I mean, of course, the beginning of the Arkenstone stuff that we've seen in the trailers has been with Thranduil. Is that going to be the moment in the film when the prominence of the Arkenstone begins really to come into focus? Or, Andrew's asking if the dancing animal waiters at Bjorn's dinner are going to do. Yeah, perhaps they're going to come out, Andrew, and do. They're going to do a musical number. The dogs and ponies. It's going to literally be a dog and pony show at Bjorn's house, and they're going to do an expositional musical number. That seems more likely than the D answer, actually.
And Brianna. Brianna asked, no, Brianna, that is incorrect. That is B. If the topic is raised in film two but repeats what we knew from the first film, that is B. A is literally it is not discussed in this film.
Yes. Yeah.
Like A is just we just leave it at what we've already been told.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. I'm going to vote. I'm ready.
You're ready?
I'm ready. I'm going with C. And the reason I'm going with C is not necessarily because of the Dominion thing, that is, like, the connection between... Whatever the link is between the Ark and Stone and Kingship, which, as I've said, I still don't understand, it's not for that reason. It is because I think that... The Ark and Stone is sufficiently famous and made a big deal of enough, even in the first film, even just as a great and marvelous jewel, that, and it's going to be enough of a focal point that some reference is going to be made to the fact that that Smaug coveted that gem. You know, Trish, thinking back to what you were saying earlier on about, you know, it being kind of, or maybe it was Dave, kind of Silmaril-like, and the way that the sort of the Silmaril-ish aspects of the Ark and Stone are going to be foregrounded. For that reason, I can see Smaug desiring it. And
that's a good point.
And them choosing to amplify the allure of the Ark and Stone by having Smaug piped up and be like, yeah, I'm here for the gem too. Because, you know, there are plenty of hordes. Like, yeah, Erebor was rich, but it wasn't the only rich place in the world. But, you know, I came here because I heard about the Ark and Stone, and I'm the only dragon who's got something like that in his collection, so that's what I really wanted.
We don't have a precedent for that in the Silmarillion, do we? I mean, Glaurung never really interacted with the Silmarils, right?
No. But see, that's a little harder because, you know, with Morgoth's relationship to the Silmarils...
Oh, right, that's
you
true.
Know, any yeah. of the any of the evil captains that tried to claim them would... Yeah. Presumably have experienced immediate demotion.
So anybody that coveted it is no longer with us.
Immediate and precipitous demotion by Morgoth. Yeah. Well, I mean, actually, no, wait, we do have one example. Karkaroth, who ate it, right?
That's right. That's right.
But that didn't pan out either.
That
so,
went well for him.
Yeah,
exactly. But, Yeah. So I think, and as far as my answer of how this could be revealed, I think it could come out in the conversation. And it leads me to this other question that I've had for a while, which is, how are we going to get the Ark and Stone? That is, where will it be? How will it be presented? Bilbo, in the book, sees it twinkling on top of the hoard. So he just, it's there, it's lying on the pile. It's on the top of the pile, but it's on the pile. And it seems to be given a place of honor on the pile because it's way up at the peak of the pile. Because Bilbo has to climb all the way up and then they see him stoop and pick something up. Is that going to be the case? We last saw the Ark and Stone disappearing into the maelstrom of the gold when Smaug, you know, buries himself in it in the prologue. Therefore, options would seem to be... the Ark and Stone is just, like, jumbled amidst the treasure, and Bilbo stumbles across it by chance, if chance you call it. Another is that he has put it in pride of place on top of the pile, as is described in the book, or he has set it back on, displaying it. He has displayed it prominently somewhere, Smaug has. I don't know. I mean, hey, this sounds like another riddle, doesn't it? But basically, the answer to that question, certain answers to that question would set up a C answer relatively easily. That is, if maybe Bilbo sees the Arkenstone while he's talking to Smaug, like during the course of their conversation, and Smaug could easily then refer to it and reference the fact that he desires it and perhaps, you know, came to desire it before.
Right, right. That's true. It could come up in a conversation between he and Bilbo. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep.
All right. So you're, you've talked yourself into that, huh?
C. I'm going with C.
Smaug falls prey to his dragon overconfidence, and he tells the invisible thief the precise location of the most valuable thing in his hoard.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yep. Right over there, just in case you want to steal. Oh, shoot.
I feel like such an idiot right now.
It's only if Bilbo steals the Arkenstone. Just a random thought. What if Bilbo steals the Arkenstone? That Smaug is aware of it, and Bilbo steals that, and that is what really sets Smaug off. And then Bilbo's got it, and then, you know, Smaug's gone, and he's talking to Thorin and stuff, and Thorin's like, you know, I wonder what really set the dragon, like, why did he get so angry and leave? And Bilbo's like, so it was this cup I took. Yeah, this cup made him.
Exactly. See, that's interesting.
Ooh. You guys are getting very creative.
That is one thing for sure about this whole, the emphasis on the emphasis on the Arkenstone. Bilbo knows what it is. He's been told repeatedly. The other dwarves know what it is. Everybody knows this is what Thorin's looking for. So this isn't like before where Bilbo's like, well, that's a pretty jewel. I'm going to just take this and kind of hold on to it. And then later on, it dawns on him what it is. Bilbo is going to take this knowing full well what it is, or at least will learn much earlier on what it is and how important it is to Thorin, which only strengthens the betrayal.
Right. That's what I was thinking.
Yes. Yep. Yep.
But anyway, back to the riddle. I'm going with B.
Okay.
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 As am I.
Come on, somebody go with D.
I had to resist Corey's silver tongue.
The safe answer, huh? I understand.
Oh, look at that.
I understand. Look at that. I wouldn't call it the cowardly approach or anything, but it is a safe answer.
Well, I'd like to get more right this year than less right than you.
Should we launch the poll?
Yes.
Yeah, we should launch the poll. Okay.
So I had to shorten the answers because it only gives me 60 characters, so hopefully you guys get it.
And
oh my goodness, look at that. Oh my gosh. Oh, neck and neck. It's neck and neck.
Yes. Somebody picked D.
But only a few have voted.
D. Come on, people.
Or A. 30% have voted. People are still thinking.
Oh, there we go. There we go. Somebody each said A and D now.
Thank you, folks.
What's Corey, just out of curiosity.
Art said A.
Based on the text. Are we to understand, like, what is sort of the canonical text interpretation of the relationship between Smaug and Necromancer? I think we've discussed this before.
Is it
really just more, like, really all we seem to get from the quest for Erebor is Gandalf's fear that had events been allowed to persist as they were, eventually Smaug would have fallen under the influence of Sauron. But not that they were coordinating from the very beginning or even while Sauron was in his guise as Necromancer. They hadn't quite gotten there yet. He was just worried that eventually they would.
Yeah. I mean, the one phrase that keeps jumping out at me as I'm recalling it, and I hope I'm remembering it accurately, is when Gandalf says that Sauron could have used the dragon to terrible effect.
Right, yeah.
And that one word, used, is the only word that we have to really draw conclusions about the actual hierarchical relationship between Sauron and Smaug. Because otherwise you could just suspect an alliance, or not even an alliance, but opportunism. Presumably it would occur to Smaug by himself if everybody is marching down towards Mordor and trying to defend against Sauron, who is attacking Gondor and moving outwards, that Sauron would think, or that Smaug, rather, would think, hey, this would be a good time to sack Rivendell. Wouldn't that be fun? And he goes and attacks. So it's not even necessary that Smaug has to be acting as a lieutenant of Sauron in order to, for Gandalf's fears still to be justified. However, that one word used seems to imply that Sauron would clearly be in the driver's seat. Now, again, it might be Sauron would exploit Smaug. Sauron would manipulate Smaug. Sauron would, you know, just kind of, you know, plan and hope that Smaug would act in certain ways, and Smaug, thinking he's doing his own thing, would end up fulfilling the will of Sauron. Maybe that's what would have happened. Maybe that's what was in Tolkien's mind. But that one word used suggests that Smaug probably would have been working for, or at least with, Sauron.
Interesting.
We have four people who have voted for D now.
Good job, people.
Whoa, D is, D is pulled equal with C.
It's equal with C, yeah.
It's probably wrong, but I'm glad you voted for it.
Interesting. Interesting. No, I mean,
I'm surprised by how few people voted for A and the possibility.
One. That, yeah, I think Art's the only one. And Art had...
it's entire, you know, that they'll basically decide that they don't need to remind us of any of this, and that the screen time shouldn't be used on rehashing facts that, that like it for the average moviegoer really doesn't add to or detract from their enjoyment of the film. Do they really care why Smaug's there? No. And we've already told you in the previous film, which we're assuming that you watched.
Yeah. Yeah.
A seems like a pretty, like, a decent bet, people. Oh, well, missed your chance.
Yeah, well, they don't get recorded like ours does. They can change their minds.
That's true. Yeah, I don't think, the more I think about it, I'm not sure that D is unlikely. It's, we'll see, it is unlikely. I don't think it's impossible, though. Yeah, we'll see. We'll see, you know, what the coordination looks like. I'm still confident in C, so I think that the three other people who joined me would be very happy that they did. And I've totally not talked you all off a cliff in the same way that I usually do. good. Well, we should let everyone go at last. It's been fun, as always. We are going to do, for next time, 2 weeks from now, we're realizing this morning we only have maybe two episodes before the film comes out. So for the next episode, we're going to do the discussion of the extended edition. So if you haven't gotten a chance to see the extended edition and the extras yet, do that, in the next 2 weeks here. And we will talk about the extended edition scenes next time. And then we will... we'll do a review in our beginning of December episode, which will probably be our last one before.
And there will be, I know, at least one more vlog, Jackson's.
Yes, yes. So. Cool. All right. So very good. Thanks, everybody, for your patience, for everyone who has borne with us for this very long and unexpectedly feisty discussion. And we have enjoyed having you with us here today. And we'll say, as always, thanks for listening, and Godspeed.